welcome to Spotlight, the official podcast of Grapple. I'm Benno.
And I'm JP.
And JP, we've just been on our pre-show, ranking our favourite Beatles, talking our favourite WCW jobbers, talking a bit of Glastonbury.
Yeah.
It's been a fun old time.
Steve Blackman. I was ruining some of the intro talk for this by bringing up stuff that you didn't want to that you wanted to say for the intro, and I thought, no, fuck it.
What's the true A show these days? Of course, it's the main show here, obviously. But you know, they just get that little bit extra off the cuff, you know.
Got my MLW review in as well, which would have been the only other bit of wrestling discussed this week, really, outside of one show.
I did throw the preview show on the main feed this week, obviously, with it being a big weekend. And like that gear change from us talking about the window, and all of a sudden you were talking about like things blowing up and stuff in MLW. I still don't really understand what happened.
Well, I mean,
MLW never stops, I think, is what we learned.
Oh yeah, it was a weapons of mass destruction match between Jacob Fatu and Mads Kruger. Jacob Fatu on the splash off the ladder. It was batshit bonkers stuff, but it was kind of fun. Because it's MLW, and they just had smoke coming from the boxes, which was the weapons of mass. So plutonium in the ECW arena. Not seen that since about 95, probably, and it knocking around them. God knows what New Jack would be bringing in on the fucking scene. Those lads would get high on anything, wouldn't they?
They'd have booked New Jack by now, by the way, if he was still around. New Jack would be like in like a battle riot or something. If he didn't before he died, he probably didn't. I'm forgetting.
I wouldn't be surprised if there is some sort of New Jack MLW run in the past. Like when they were doing like Carino and the Extreme Horseman, it's like, clearly bring him in, wouldn't you, for that? But yeah, so they had nuclear weapons, and Jacob, it looks like Mads Kruger's lost his mask because Jacob Fatu threw his head into the Ark of the Covenant and took that off. So that's MLW, really. You know, that was the only other bit of wrestling. Yeah, sure. I've gone away again. The Asia Myron Reed is a middleweight champion, as it is, but it's all roads lead to Battle Riot 4, which I'd recommend. And again, repeat this on the pre-show as well. I'd recommend John Cena's report on post wrestling.
Definitely, he's the man.
He's the man.
I was gonna say, the other thing that shocked me on the pre-show was that you didn't watch any Glastonbury at the weekend. You straight in the JP, you'd be a big festival goer in this time. You know, not for you. It was never really my thing.
I was getting over COVID, mate, and I didn't want to see people having fun because it had been nice weather and I'd been asleep for large swathes of the week, like feeling like shit. So, like, I wasn't in the mood for seeing people having a great fucking time. I mean, people were, you saw a couple of bits, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I watched Kendrick Lamar and I watched a bit of Pet Shop Boys, always worth a watch. Kendrick Lamar is like, he's one of them where like I'm so out of tune with like any rapper that came out past 1999. I don't really know anything about them, but I kind of discovered as he went through his set, oh yeah, they had this song like in the background on like Insecure, or I'm sure like one of them was like an outro song for Atlanta or something like that.
Yeah,
you know, through inertia, you know, I'm still down. That's an incredible set, mate. Yeah, well, yeah, it's shocking, really. You know, what's the best festival you've been to, JP? That's what I was going to ask you. That's what I wanted to know. That's what I saved from the pre-show.
The best festival I've ever been to.
In the heady days of about your 90s, JP, you got a four times.
Weirdly enough, I didn't do anything kind of like bonkers festival wise. I'm trying to think. Like, I mean, the last one I've been at, this is a hell of a long time ago. This is like sort of early 2000s, like a V festival. It was headlined by the Chemical Brothers. You can imagine what I was like at that point in time. I hadn't become a dad yet. That was to come. And then people went, oh, you can bring your kids to festivals. And I was like, fuck off. I'm going to a festival for me. I'm not going there to be dad. Like, that's that ain't happening. So I, for shame, haven't been for years.
Is there an appropriate age to go to a festival? I feel like I'm getting too old now. You know, obviously last week, I'm up to 38. I saw like a tweet about that saying, like, you know, everyone over the age of 35 at a festival, listen, you're just creeping the rest of us out. I kind of get that vibe,
folk,
you know?
Like folk festivals.
Yeah. Hippie dads.
I'm not at that point. Yeah, I'm not at that point. Like, I live in Oxford. I've met a lot of people who, like, there's a lot of them that run near here. Like, there's one at Cornbury. There's Truck Festival and stuff like that. And Supergrass always headline because they're from Oxford. And I'm just like, I don't need to hear it all right again. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think like the typical Scouse bands, the fucking headliner. Like Space will always get a gig. Like there'll be like a random festival in a park somewhere in Liverpool. Oh, we'll space out. Go on, they'll do it. They'll do it for nothing.
The Ocean Colour Scene from Liverpool.
I think so. Like, it's a shock. It'd be a shock to me if they were though.
That appears to be the kind of thing, doesn't it? Like,
Teutons, like they'll do a lot of stuff. Cast's another one. You see a lot of like Cast doing like those types.
They were supporting like Oasis when I went to see them at Nebworth. That time, that was a bit mad. Adidas t-shirt. I didn't wear that, but
those this is Leo with the chat. it's one of them. I think we're all kind of, everyone in our chat's kind of saying we're all too old for those days.
Birmingham for Ocean Colour Scene. We're throwing lot of big musical choices already at this stage of the game.
I was having a good time watching it. Like, I was watching it Saturday. I had a few like beers and stuff, and like ended up like, I don't know what it was that popped into my head, but because it was Glastonbury, like that. Remember that old like aerial advert where like the kid walks in the living room and the mum asks him how the festival was, and he's like, "Oh, Glastonbury, and you would have loved it." Do you remember that? Like that popped right into my head. It's like a weird nostalgia thing that popped up in my brain, and I found myself on Saturday night in the end watching like. This is how like party my Saturday night was, watching like 90s adverts, like compilations of adverts, and like it was this weird thing where like my brain was waiting for some show to start, but it never did. I was just sitting there endlessly watching like, you know, like the old PG Tips adverts and like the family the tap and stuff, and the
R-White's Lemonade.
Yeah, well, do you know what I noticed? Like, the biggest thing I noticed was like, well, what? Like, I
need drink.
that popped in my head. I don't have a TV license, as we've argued about over the years. So I legitimately don't watch live TV. Don't see adverts anymore. But when the odd time when I do, let's say I'm at my mum's or something like that, like, there's not a lot of adverts for like, in the 90s, there was a lot of adverts for like junk food, but it was just all like just sweets. It'd be like, you know. There's a new Coke out, or like one I saw, there was an advert for a Drifter bar, and that blew out. I was like, oh, fucking hell, I remember Drifters. And I was going down, it's like, do you know what I mean? Like, adverts for just basic things that you can get in the shop, like a packet of Maltesers. Do we still do that? Because I feel like you just go in and you pick, don't you? Like, does there need to be like a, you know, a Mad Men style ad campaign to convince you that like this type, like a Whisper bar is better than a Mars bar or whatever? I don't know. Do we do that now? I feel like that's been lost to time.
Oh, no. We're in the era of product placement, mate. This is, you know, they're the kind of things that you like to sneak in, like this delicious glass of Professor Pepe's from Aldi, which obviously by the name is joking. better than Dr. Pepper. Are you drinking it?
I got an Aldi root beer.
Oh, you got a root beer.
Aldi, though. I went up the
Aldi
weekend.
Aldi root beer.
I went in, I sort of said this
Professor
to Gareth.
Professor Pepe, though. Expert trolling.
They caught me this weekend. I thought I bought some Frank's Red Hot, which is the proper buffalo sauce, because the logo was picture perfect on the Aldi one. It was like, but they let the bit where it would say Frank's was a lot smaller, and I just saw like Red Hot sauce and bought it and got home and realized my mistake. I can't believe I'm fucking 38 years old and I'm still getting caught out by all these fake brands, but they got me a
Bramwell's, was it?
But yeah, I'd be saying here, I bet Jerry for definitely. You just see a Derry and Coffin Dutchess, pretty much. Yeah, it's like your daytime TV ads. So. There's not like Simon said, there's not like the old Tango ads from the 90s, you know.
Did you do that
at school?
The Tango, man. Did we do it? Fucking did we? Like,
honestly, concussions being thrown out there.
Move like a ninja. That was. Mate, and it was brutal as well. There were some big lads dishing out. And if anyone doesn't know, effectively in those adverts, they had like a double hand slap. So it'd be like, bang, like properly on both cheeks. Now, in the advert, there's a delay. There's a man who runs out, spray painted orange, like comes up and it's just like, you've been tangoed. So it'd be like, to replicate the hit of when Tango hits you. This is product placement, folks. Like this entire description of a Tango advert. But yeah, and it was a mad thing on the playgrounds. And they like had to change the ad campaign quite quickly to do that. Like it felt like they did, but the genie was out of the bottle.
Yeah. Now,
it was a new way to punish people. So there'd be people going in for a piss and they'd like open up the toilet door and just get fucking slapped right in there. right in the face.
Yep, my school was the same. Simon says, yeah, he remembers Abbott for life insurance during daytime. Do F repeats in the 90s, free pens all over the place. Yeah, what's that about, like, the wrestling? What does it say about the wrestling audience? Not much, I don't think.
Was it Lloyd's of London? Because it feels like they're the ones who should have been advertising. I didn't know any. I still know remarkably little about insurance.
Oh, wow, Lloyd's, that, though.
The Lloyd's of London, though, is something that's drilled into my head as, like, that was the deal to fucking get.
It was a British firm that just got fucked by all these 90s wrestlers just taking the absolute piss out of them because they were daft enough to insure a load of wrestlers who, you know, were walking around with their arms full and legs full enough as it was that would, like, you know, run-of-the-mill wrestler injuries are things that, like, would retire, like, you know, a footballer or even, like, a tennis player or a golfer or whatever. Like, wrestlers are just like, I'll work the next town. Like, any like, bog-standard wrestling injury was probably enough to get a full statement there.
Oh, mate. Like, it was mad, wasn't it? It was Rick Rude and Perfect are the ones I always remember. They're the ones who had the kind of... Because that's why Perfect, like, it was like he had to break that Lloyd's of London contract. So God knows how much WCW offered him to kind of, like, sort of go and actually wrestle there. But, yeah. And Rick Rude was going to as well, wasn't he? That was the whole thing.
There was all the weird ones, wasn't there? Like, there was, like, was it Road Warrior Animal? Who had, like, some... Because he was even working...
Not Hawk, obviously.
But he was working in WWF in the 90s, in the 2000s, wasn't he? But he was only working tag matches. Because it's, like, the one thing had, like, you can't work singles matches, but you can actually still work tags, because that was him, wasn't it? I'm sure
that
was him.
How in the name of Christ do you get that on an insurance policy?
He conned them into thinking it would... obviously, you might get injured less.
Upper middle class bloke in the city of London. And he's there going, well, sorry, animal. Can't believe I'm calling you this. Like, why don't you? It's Joe Laurinaitis, isn't he? That was animals in brackets.
The forgotten brother.
Shout out Dave Meltzer. but yeah, like, how are they just discussing this on the phone with him? They're drawing up these contracts that he can't work. It would explain why in Qatari pro wrestling he made an appearance, took out the tag champions, but he wasn't technically a match.
Well, it's like when we were talking on the TNA flashback we did this week, the month one episode, like Ricky Steamboat, that was a big thing. And I'm pretty sure when he was in Ring of Honor, like, he didn't do a match with Punk, but they did, like, a fight that, you know, didn't really end at a pinfall or whatever, but it was basically a match without being a match. I think that was a way to get around the Lloyd's of London thing. Like, I don't know. Maybe, saying that, he's wised up now. I think they were trying to get him to do that. Have you seen that Ric Flair pay-per-view that's coming up? The fucking last match ever thing, the Starcast. It's on SummerSlam weekend, isn't it? Like, we're watching that and reviewing it 100%, but, like, if Ric Flair dies in the ring, will any of us be shocked? Like, that interview he did this week where he was, like, on the press conference, wasn't it, where he was like, yeah, you know, I'd like a pacemaker or whatever fitted, but you can take that out, you know, I'll be fine, it's still good. And it's like,
put it back in. And I was like, that feels like a kind of an operation type of job. Call me funny, seeing as you need that for your heart to beat. Which, this is mental. Like,
I love that he hasn't got an opponent yet because no one's mental enough to take him up on it. Like, and I think I'm pretty sure, like, there's supposed to be AEW talent on that show. I think they've mostly been pulled because it could easily be like this fucking, you know, for the sake of, like, what, a couple hundred grand, Conrad wheeling out the fucking corpse of Ric Flair and getting him to do it a couple more chops and take a couple of bumps.
His father-in-law, no less.
Easily end in disaster. That's the weirdest fucking thing in the world, by the way. How did Conrad marry into that family? Like, that's even worse. That we were having to go with Triple H last week. I feel like that's up there.
Jesus Christ! Like, that's he said he was aiming to be better than, but he'll be better than 2009 Ric Flair. That won't be difficult as well. Like, that really won't be. But no, can't say I'm looking forward to it. Like, it feels...
I kind of... Like, well, they've announced some good matches. Wow. Like, the Wolves versus Shitty Machine Guns, I think, on the undercard. Yeah. There's a couple of other... You know, they're rounding off the card well. It's just, you know... And they moved to a bigger stadium too, you know, moved to a bigger room.
They did. They moved to the Nashville Municipal Auditorium, which was going to be the permanent home of TNA at one point.
Oh.
Thank God. It holds about 8,000, which would be a mental idea. like
you know, there's an, I think again the only way they draw
win
that's
the tarpaulin salesman.
Yeah, that's it. Well, on that note, yeah, before we got into the main stuff, we did talk some TNA this week. I didn't want to throw it a quick plug in for our month one we did this week. That was a fucking trip down memory lane. Me, you and Matty talking the first two TNA shows. Like, I felt like it was weird because I felt like I'd seen them. But I almost like think definitely, I've definitely seen the first one at some point. But the second episode, like, I think I just read the 4-1 report and have convinced myself in the years since I'd seen it. Because, like, I haven't watched it. It felt completely new. Yous were making fun of me for not knowing who David Young was. Still not certain that he's not, like, been, you know...
Shocking.
It's not a Mandela effect thing where yous all lived in a world where David Young existed and I didn't. Because
Matty was proper disgusted by your lack of David Young knowledge. Not even the spine buster, no. That didn't hold it there. It would, you know.
Obviously in the wrong circles. Apparently he did some Ring of Honor appearances as well, but like, yeah, no memories, no recollection. I just think he obviously did that Slammiversary Battle Royal last week, didn't he? And yeah, the reverse Battle Royal, and everyone was going crazy. Feels like something I'd have been into, mate, but no. Never heard of him. Never heard of the fuck ever. There was a few names like that. Fucking Gareth was saying to us today, wasn't he, about what's his name? Del Rios.
Del Rios.
On the show, which is not Alberto Del Rio. It's also not S.A. Rios, but it's apparently the man almost also known as Phantasma. Like he was a standout. The Wall on the show was a standout. Flying Elvises. Yeah. A lot of characters I've forgotten about.
T.O. versus Hollywood.
Fucking hell, that was rough.
I know. Just like it's a miracle how they got to 20 years watch these first couple.
They built the entire first show around a feud between Jeff Jarrett and fucking Jackie Fargo. Like, Jackie Fargo.
I know.
Honestly, like that, yeah, that's gonna get like the next generation of wrestling fans in the fucking Fargo Strut.
I quite like Memphis, but not that. Like, I mean, who next? Would they bring him up Moondog Spot? Like, I mean, like, how deep into the rabbit hole do you need to go to appeal to that particular audience? Yeah, it was great fun, though, to kind of watch and record as well.
My favourite bit was Matty burying Will Smith. Like, Matty's been like 10 minutes.
Mate.
If you want to hear Matty with a grudge against someone, listen to his take on Will Smith. Like, I was a big fan of, you know, getting jiggy with it. Summertime with Jazzy Jeff, you know, great musical career. Some fun movies he did, Men in Black, you know, the likes, which stars of the composite, not Matty. Real beef there. It was, yeah. Good.
Proper hatred.
Good look into the mind frame of 2002 Matty, who apparently spent all his days playing EWR and his evenings hating Will Smith. I was with him on the days, just not the evenings.
Well, like, I'm not sure if you're aware of this or if the listeners are aware of this, but he slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars and we discussed it.
we might
be a tad late to the conversation, but like at least we said our two.
You'll find out where we stand on that obviously important you know issue.
Massive. Massive. But yeah, also, you know, we've had that on there at the
Sorry, Liam's putting it in the chat here to correct you here, JP. Moondog Spot did appear in the Russo era of TNA and team with Jim Duggan. Of course he fucking did.
Of course he did.
So that's the next flashback we do, month, whatever, TNA, when that month
Russo, happened. who introduced himself to the TNA audience with that other well-known sort of young, you know, someone to attract the younger fan in coming in as like Mr. Wrestling 3 or something like that, didn't he? I was like, yeah, that'll work. Like, do that. Bring in Ivan Koloff while you're there. Like, just get all the fucking 70s.
That was Russo all over, though, wasn't it? It was like, all old wrestling is bad, except for this very specific period that I've got nostalgia for. We'll redo all that. I blew my mind, though, that he wasn't around during that early run of NWA TNA because, you know, the Johnsons, there were a whole load of ideas that were right up his street.
Oh, like, Matty was absolutely insistent that he wasn't involved and that he was there. I can't help but feel he was shifting a few ideas.
Maybe.
Either that or, like, compared to, like, Ed Ferrara, he's the one who comes across as the sane, rational, reasonable one. But, like, no, it's just fucking batshit, really, when you think about it like that. But, yeah, we did that on the...
You've been busy as well.
Have. So we finished off Kenobi season 1. So hello there.
How did it end? Spoilers?
I'm not going to fucking spoil it, mate. No, I'm not going to do that. It was a better last episode. We reviewed the last two episodes because between COVID and work, we didn't get a chance to record. So we did those two episodes together. See, episode 5 we ripped into. It's just full of loads of plot holes and stuff like that. Episode 6 is better as well. But yes, we had that out recently on the show as well. So that's out on the free feed at the moment. On top of that, like obviously we've got we did our weekend show and preview for this one today on Forbidden Door. We've got quite a back catalogue of stuff on there, and we will be doing a State of AEW podcast, we're hoping.
The original plan was to do like a Hangman Page deep cut, or the assassination of Hangman Page by the coward Benson Richards, as coined by Chris Leno, like we did with Kenny Omega and his title run. But it's kind of like snowballed now into, I think we're going to do like a full, maybe keep this up, a half year in review of AEW, you know, January to June. We'll have the full period in the can with Grapple Gareth, who will be joining us, whose idea this was, by the way. So you can look forward to Gareth coming to it. If you think we're too bad, he'll be coming to stick the knife in. We'll be talking the positive, the negative, you know, the storylines across time, you know, Hangman Page's run as champion, obviously will be chief among that, you know, looking at the business metrics and numbers and stuff like that. So, you know, we're always always positive about AEW, mate. So, you know, I think it's going to be a nice,
always positive mate.
Happy chat. Yeah. And
never wrong as well. Never wrong.
Hey, we'll discuss that today. Still think we're fucking right, but anywho. That'll be coming up, but obviously as well, we've got Tokyo Joshi Pro Deep Dive, as Carl points out in the chat here. Simon's Heart Foundation versus Steve Austin from the 97 podcast, which will be in touch this week, Simon, about getting sorted out as well. So yeah, plenty of stuff coming there on the Patreon side. But yeah, you know, on the subject of AEW and their first 6 months of the year, I think this is kind of a bit of a one subject show this today, isn't it, JP? Like you said at the top, there's a other than
two in many ways, isn't there? There's two companies.
I suppose so. But we're getting two for one. Although you didn't watch it, there's no other wrestling there that caught your eye over the weekend, mate, other than whatever the fuck was going on at MLW?
No, not really. I haven't had a chance to watch the Stardom show. Yeah. That was the only other like kind of big show. It felt like there was a deliberate, because obviously it's what the focus of AEW and New Japan was. So there was very little else. I think there's Money in the Bank this weekend.
But we're not even fucking podcast this. Oh, that's Vegas, by the way, isn't it? Which is that's the one that got moved down from the Allegiant Stadium. Brilliant. That's the kind of thing. Like, I was like looking for, you know, over the weekend, like wrestling podcast wise. Like, I think everyone and the kid had done a Forbidden Door preview, because it was kind of all there was to talk about. It was, you know, whether we were excited for the show or not. It was the big wrestling news story of the weekend, wasn't it? So yeah, that's the main talking point, the main thing we'll get into. So yeah, without further ado, JP, should we talk how right we were, or how wrong we were, or somewhere in between? I don't know where we're gonna land on this. Did see a lot of talk over the show being turning out to be good, therefore, you know, the people who criticized the AEW coming in must be wrong. You know, maybe we'll fess up to some things. No, we fucking won't. We're old school message board posters. We will never admit to being wrong on anything. But no, like, it's obviously been really well received, and I think we were gonna have a lot of positive to say about it. But did you watch this thing live, JP? I'm guessing you didn't. You weren't up till 5 in the morning, mate, last night.
No, and this is the thing, I've been in a kind of a silo before this, so I haven't really, like, I managed to stay kind of pretty spoiler free. I managed to avoid it. I was at work all day, and then when I got back there was a few little bits and bobs, and then I've kind of watched the show, and then here I am. So I, in terms of like a general consensus, like, I think if you're wanting like a kind of an overview from me, I thought the show was a lot of fun. And I think there's some like really good stuff on there, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would do. However, like, ultimately, Like, I thought there were things like, in terms of, if you think about the sort of the USP of these shows is a kind of like matches that you would kind of put up there as kind of what you might think of as classic sort of singles encounters. We didn't really get that, but we did have a lot of kind of what I kind of expected, where there'd be kind of cool interactions on the undercard, and they played that stuff kind of perfectly and gave it enough time to kind of breathe as well. So this, even though it's like near 4 hours, is that right? And then you've got like all of the bloody buy-in as well. This didn't feel like Double or Nothing, where like I was struggling. It was like an endurance test.
Yeah, it felt like it was just a really fun, easy to watch pay-per-view. Mm. Like I had a fucking great time last night watching this, and we were douring the build up to it, and you know, stand by everything we said, the build up was bad. The card they put together was not the, you know, the optimum or befitting of, you know, the grandiose idea of a New Japan versus a AEW card. But you know, as we said on the pre-show, and I think, you know, as I think most podcasts like ours really, you were critical of the build, kind of said, I mean, this is not the story of AEW right now. You know, we are extremely low on the booking week to week, but we know, and it's absolutely apparent when you watch these Dynamites, that at the end of the day, some of the best wrestlers in the world, you put them in matches, even if the booking around them is like on fire, they're gonna have great matches. Yeah, that's the absolute benefit of AEW, that they allow, you know, they give 20 minutes for Moxley and Kyle O'Reilly, just whatever you think of the booking leading up to it, to go out there and have a banging match. They'll go out there and they'll give you a banging match. So is it a surprise that some of the literally tippy top best wrestlers in the world went out there, and despite the circumstances, despite, you know, the less than optimum build and less than optimum card, you know, in front of, and let's throw this praise out, an absolutely killer Chicago crowd who, you know, raised the level
of
absolutely everything and everyone, and with, you know, a whole bunch of New Japan wrestlers who haven't really worked so much in front of lively crowds, apart from the odd New Japan USA show these last couple of years, went out to kill it. And yeah, I think even the people who were maybe on the opposite end to us, who maybe enjoyed the build or were, you know, more excited than we were for matches like Orange Cassidy and Will Ospreay, or, you know, Tanahashi and John Moxley, I think it even exceeded, you know, I think the reasonable expectations of those people. It was a show that massively, massively over-delivered.
Yeah, and I think that's the other key word for it, is like kind of over-delivered. And it was, I felt with that crowd kind of willed it to be much better than perhaps like what we were given, which was like, you know, on the undercard, like a hell of a lot of fun. Like just in terms of those opening, was it 3-4 matches that were just like, Jesus, these are all a lot of fun. In
party,
their
man.
Own, it was just like a real party, and everyone was there to just go, no, like the build be damned, we're gonna love this show, and they did, and they, and
15,000
like,
odd people in a building who you know had bought these tickets before, you know, knowing what the card was, you know, and they went there and they went with, you know, the right attitude, I think, to go out there and have, you know, be there and enjoy the moment and have fun and raise everything there. And I do think that's part of it as well. I think like the negative feeling across the board, because, you know, I think it kind of started where, like, you know, you'd hear like a lot of criticism of AEW booking from Wade Keller and the likes. I think we've been relatively critical over time, but as the weeks went on, it got close to the pay-per-view. I don't think I listened to any preview podcast pretty much that was you know, positive about the build. There's variations on, you know, how excited people were for, you know, the card itself and what they thought the upper limits of, you know, the quality of the card could be. But it felt like, yeah, everybody and their dog was kind of feeling like we were, feeling like, it definitely felt like there was definitely a dour feeling, you know, over the weekend on Twitter and the like, of you know, negative feeling towards the show, and probably seeped through to the wrestlers, because the wrestlers went out there with the attitude of, we're going to kill it. And like I said, you put the best wrestlers in the world out there and let them work matches, and yeah, you know, you're going to get a result like this. It was, yeah, everyone, like Darren says here in the chat, you know, felt like a super indie where everyone got brought in, got the shit in and had fun, you know. It definitely felt like one of those shows where it was just, they struck lightning, didn't they? They struck gold. It just worked. And yeah, it despite did. All of our complaints, you know, people like us, the build and what the car could have been, You know, you can't argue. You know, I think there's definitely it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the show actually did as far as buys go. You know, Tony Khan was relatively high on that expectation of it in the press bit I saw afterwards. He was still expecting, you know, in the 100,000 range. I believe Double or Nothing, they're expecting in the 150,000 range. But, you know, 100 plus he cited as a victory. We were kind of saying that on the weekend show. So, you know, if that comes to fruition, that's true. Mm. But yeah, the truth of the matter is the people like us who were feeling negative about the show going in, if you didn't watch it, you ended up missing out. Like it did end up being, you know, like I say, over-delivering. I think that's the word, you know, over-delivering and fun. They're the two words I think we're going to be saying a lot as we go through this show.
Well, it's interesting because the build to this, obviously, as we spoke about in the weeks for this, and absolutely standby was a mess. It was like a complete mess. A lot of the stuff that built this within the actual show itself was stuff taken from the countdown to Forbidden Door.
That was great. That was wonderful. Yeah, we hadn't seen that.
They're always great. And it's just like, but they exist in this little vacuum of YouTube and then late, really late night after Rampage. And it's like, this is the kind of stuff that you want to be putting on. Like as a, you know, when, you know, you need to have it in a lot more slots. You need to have it within the show because there's a lot of great production work that goes into it. And that made it kind of feel more important as well. And so you've got the kind of combinations of, you've got some really, like really high quality, good wrestling in front of a really hot crowd where, you know, there is like, you know, and they're rising to this level. And then a shout out for the commentary, certainly for the first half of the show, where you felt like Excalibur could breathe because he wasn't the person who was being expected to actually know all of the information. There was a sense that Taz is going to do a lot more heavy lifting, certainly than Jim Ross and more than Tony Schiavone, who's always had his kind of limitations to a degree. And then you've got Kevin Kelly in there, who is able to go in there and effectively play kind of color commentator as well. And I just thought he was tremendous because he was able to talk about New Japan. You know, generally Taz and Excalibur obviously kind of know what he's talking about. So you've got like the kind of duties being shared amongst the three of them. And they had like just a lovely dynamic as well. Like I thought that worked. I thought it was tremendous as well. I thought Kevin Kelly was quite funny at points for some of the stuff, but, and then JR comes out.
No, there was that. Yeah, it was funny on the pre-show when it was Excalibur, Taz and Kevin Kelly. I was like, well, this is the pre-show. You know, they're going to wheel out JR and Schiavone and they're going to fuck off this fun dynamic. And they, you know, yeah, you know, we'll get into the odd time they decided to wheel Jim Ross out there, like Orange Cassidy versus Will Ospreay. Wouldn't have been my choice as an introduction to Jim Ross on this show. But yeah, I think that... You know, we could talk about, you know, in general, the presentation of it as an element of the presentation. You know, I thought the ring announcing, you know, having Justin Roberts and the Japanese ring announcer, was it something Shibata, isn't it?
Yeah,
with him out there. I mean, he was a little bit funny because he just, you know, for like the first few matches, he was just kind of nonchalantly repeating the names and like that Justin Roberts had just said. And then in the main events, I feel like they could have done like some kind of better combo of the two, but it was cool. They had them both. Bit weird they didn't fly the refs over. I thought that was a bit missing. I thought as far as, you know, even Andy Q will do that, you know, fly over Tiger Tori or Red Shoes or whoever it was at, you know, the time. Obviously you might need to update those references, but yeah, there's definitely you know, maybe slightly missing that. But you know, as far as presenting it as like a joint show, like, I thought they nailed it. You know, the commentary wise, Taz probably wouldn't have entered my brain as like, that's the guy who should be on the call with Excalibur and Kevin Kelly. Like I would have expected, you know, with his New Japan, you know, USA commentary he used to do on, what was it on? It was the old chat, the channel TNA's on, wasn't it? Those old 1 hour New Japan Access TV.
Access, yeah.
Yeah, I would have thought maybe they'd lean into that and use JR for the full show. Well, you know, they used him sparingly, which was a dream. And I thought Taz was fantastic. You know, I just thought it was, in parts, you know, it was lighthearted and fun, you know, the banter between, you know, him and Excalibur that they kind of do on Dark anyway, with Kevin Kelly getting involved, and then when it needs to be serious and you need to tell the story of the matches, Taz was right there too. I just thought, if anything, it was an advert for, you know, this is probably what the AEW commentary, you know, should be going forward. This is probably the team. And they even worked in, you know, Caprice Coleman I was appreciative of the fact that, you know, they didn't involve Chris Charlton. I just don't think he's a... I mean, it's a controversial take within our bubble, but I don't think he's a very good commentator at all. But he's a very good translator and good at providing information. But, you know, I don't think I would have squeezed even, you know, Jim Ross or Tony Schiavone out the booth to have him in there. But I thought, you know, using Kevin Kelly in that role was perfect. They used, you know, Chris Charlton for the translations after the show in the press conference, which I thought was a good move too. And all in all, I just felt like they absolutely nailed it.
They did. And that's been, like, that was one of the things at Double or Nothing. I think they'd used, like, kind of, was it five or six commentators on this. And they kind of had an equal number, but it was, I was glad to see Caprice Coleman get a shot on there as well. And Rick Abonne would be, if you're not going to get Kevin Kelly from New Japan, Rick Abonne is like your next kind of best pickup for that, if you are going to do that as well. And Taz just needs to be on the commentary booth. Like, it's the thing now where he manages to, like, I mean, apart from, I always thought, like, in TNA, he always felt a bit weird because he was replacing Don West, who's so much kind of integral to who, like, kind of TNA was. So it's like a very much different dynamic. But yeah, like you mentioned, they it felt like we were being, for the very first time in this whole, since Forbidden Door was happening, we were having things explained to us throughout the show at a pace where you could kind of take it in. And even then, like I say, it was a long show, but you felt like you had Kevin Kelly in there to kind of give the right context as well. And, you know, they
and
had
he probably, to his defense, probably, and it's Simon saying here, he's pro Chris Charlton himself. He probably had Chris Charlton in his ear giving him those facts. Like, Chris Charlton's great at that. I just don't think he's good at, you know, emotive talking or broadcasting, especially when you got a whole load of pros there. But yeah, you know, I think that was the perfect setup for it. I think it really, really worked really well. But yeah, we might as well get into the show. And we said before, we'll probably go through this in chronological order. I think it's the best way to do it. The story of the night. And I'm sure we can probably talk about this as a whole. We'll kick off with the buy-in. Obviously, yeah. Goto and Yoshihashi beating Aaron Solo and QT Marshall. Lance Archer beating Nick Camerato. Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland beating Despy and Kanemaru. And Max Caster and, I'd say, the Gun Club, but Billy Gunn defeating your young boys there. A variety of matches there, JP, but a lot of fun stuff in there, and like the perfect way to kick things off. I thought this buy-in again blew away expectations that I had for it, and yeah, it was just a riot right through, I thought.
Yeah, this is the strange thing, isn't it? They kind of packed this buy-in four matches, and I think Lance Archer and Nick Camerato was like a late addition to the buy-in as well, wasn't it? You said it was just one of the ones from Rampage that they kind of just had thrown on, and you're like, oh, okay. But I mean, I thought, with the exception of, like, I enjoy the Acclaimed and the Gun Club being together. I'm fine with a lot of that stuff as the kind of this, like, undercard unit, like, kind of going through there. It does work. It's entertaining. It's perfect for the kind of buy-in stuff. I didn't think it made the Young Lions look particularly good. The Billy Gunn.
What was
Gunn.
The deal with the two Colton boys? Like, were they injured or, like, why did they do this angle where they ran off? Was it just...
I don't know.
It feels like they're all marks for Billy Gunn backstage. Like, they're like, look at the size of him. Ah, no one could legitimately beat Billy. We need to book him as this monster. Or it would be... If we did it 4-on-4, it wouldn't be credible. Is that the logic? Like, I don't really... Because in the end, Jerry just, like... To be honest, I didn't even think it made Max Caster look good, to be honest. Like, Billy Gunn just demolished... It was Alex Coughlin he pinned. Like, just demolished him. And then Max Caster, it's a, you know, pretty token elbow drop off the top to pin. Like, it was the Billy Gunn show.
DKC who finally saw.
Yeah. Still couldn't pick him out of a lineup, but especially not after
it's his name, by the way, in case you're curious. I can't remember what it is. I think his first name's Dylan, but it's like, that's all right. Who the DKC Dylan. Is.
I don't think I'd seen Kevin Knight before either. But yeah, it was...
great drop kick on him. He just needs to fill out. It's time. It's stuff like that.
And it's no, like, travesty having them beat like this, but I don't know. You would have expected it to be a little bit more competitive. And yeah, I don't see what the issue was with doing 4 versus 4 with, unless, as Darren said here in the chat, yeah, we needed to give 60-year-old Billy Gunn the rub, brother. Like, that seems to be the way things are.
No, it didn't work for him, brother, did it? before? No, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think they kind of, but like, I'm not going to be upset by an undercard match on a buy-in to a pay-per-view.
I'm still a laugh.
Because it did the job of what it was meant to do, which is, it was a laugh. I thought that Ass Boys tune that they had Danhausen play, I still don't get. Like, I thought that was quite funny. Like, just the tune itself, like, made me laugh. Like, the idea of them mucking up the, you know, saying Tokyo Dome and the rest of it. It's like, it's, if you've got that crowd and you're looking to get them, like, kind of hyped up for the main show, this is the kind of stuff that you put on there as well. But, I mean, in terms of the other stuff.
I was going to say, just on them, though, like, it's, they're an attitude era act. It's what they are. Like, there's no, you know, Max Caster shouldn't be a main eventer. There shouldn't be any, oh, let's move them to the upper mid card, or let's move them up. No, they're fine in this role. Fun catchphrases that are over with the fans that everyone enjoys, and like you say, gets everyone going. Mm-hmm. And that's where they belong on the card, and they can lose. You know, it's absolutely fine. Yeah, maybe, Billy and Max Caster.
The new Asian outlaw.
That could work. But yeah, it's stupid. As Darren said, it's stupid. It should be annoying. I don't even get off of it. Like, the scissor and stuff and half of the references kind of go over my, you know, 38-year-old head. But, like, whatever. It's funny. It works. It you know, it's something people have latched onto. You know, yeah. Great role for them to be the main event of this undercard.
And we've always said with the Acclaimed as well, and it's a shame that Bowens is out, because he was getting very good. There was a point in time he was having some. It always feels like one of them is injured as the other one. And then, like, because Max Caster was out for a long time, and it was Anthony Bowen having these, like, kind of singles matches, and he was getting better. He was in there again, you know, I think he was in there, was he against Danielson and Moxley and all manner of kind of people, and having, like, kind of really good TV matches. They're the kind of act, though, that if their contract came up, WWE should be looking at. Like, that's the kind of talent I feel. It's like, I feel like they would know better how to harness it into something else. Like, I mean, obviously they do some, you know, they might have to do something with the tone of it. And I thought his rap was quite funny. Like, it was like kind of the sort of anti-New Japan rap, I thought was good. But the other three matches on here, like on the app, I've gone like kind of like 2.5 stars for like the tag match, or like both of the tag matches, but that's not like saying they're bad. They're like 6 to 8 minutes long, and they were a lot of fun, and their job wasn't to burn out the crowd and give them stuff that was really great. It was just presenting a lot of people. It was just like putting people on the show. And it sounds like, obviously, that was a big criticism that I have, and I still think it's absolutely valid, about the amount of people they try and put onto a show. But weirdly here, it worked.
That's interesting.
Because they didn't.
I was a lot higher on Swerve, Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland against Despy and Kanemaru. I thought that was like I go way higher than 2.5. I think I went 3.5 maybe to 3.75.
Let me have a check on that one then. I might have gone like 3 stars, but then that was the only thing I did see live, and I was like pretty much falling asleep.
I was a killer. No, it was just fun. Well. It was like a Despy and Kanemaru, like. Endless kind of legwork. Like, I'm sure Gareth would have been into the targeting of the knee they were doing, and, you know, the submission based stuff they were doing with it to try and ground Keith Lee, and then Keith Lee just kind of launching them around, which is what he's best at with the smaller lads. Oh yeah, I thought that was one of the stronger matches of the night. In fact, I thought it really was good. I'm just looking at the app now. That one's it's got an average of 3.5, so like that's kind of where it is.
Yeah.
Kind of where I am as well. But yeah, I thought that was the absolute.
The stuff on this show I do want to watch again, because I've kind of like squeezed it in for this, but it feels like a show that actually it's that much fun. It could be quite fun to go back and watch it again. Sorry, using the word fun far too much on there as well. I've got, like, in terms of the post match stuff, and it's like. And they're looking to break up Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland already, which kind of feeds into the problem that I have, that they've signed these two wrestlers, don't really know what to do with them, put them together as a team, and then having them break up. And it's like, how long have they both been there? Like, if that feels like the route they're going down in the never-ending feud with Team Taz, which is just like such a placeholder for all of them when you kind of want to see them progress.
I would have liked to have seen, you know, the Team Taz lads on the show itself. But yeah, I get what you're saying. But no, I kind of like that as like a little post match promo bit. And the other two matches on the pre show, you know, Lance Archer and Nick Comoroto, was a bit messy, but it was kind of two big lads having a a messy match, which is kind of fine. You know, I feel almost harsh giving it to 2 stars in the app because I don't actually think the work was particularly good, but it was a fun spectacle. You know, Nick Camarota's got a long way to go, but, you know, he was there to put Lance Archer over, who did feel a little bit lost in the shuffle, considering he's the lad that they're sending over to the G1. You would have thought he might have had something a little bit more prominent to do on the show. It was almost like they just remembered last minute, oh, yeah, we haven't given him a match. We'll add him to the buy-in. You can smash through Nick Camarota. So, you know, they saved themselves last minute with that. I thought that was fine. And yeah, I thought, you know, Goto and Yoshihashi got a nice pop as the first New Japan guys coming out. I think there's definitely a, you know, an interesting note there that Goto was apparently, you know, a big enough deal to be one of the 3 men handpicked other than the winner of the Battle Royal to be the number one contenders for the AEW title. You know, having lost to Tanahashi, he is now working a tag in the opener of the buy-in with Aaron Solo and QT Marshall. I think if anything could tell you that there was maybe a split in, you know, there are decisions New Japan made and there are decisions Tony Khan made. I think that probably tells you that, you know, him being in that tournament was a New Japan decision, and throwing him in there against Aaron Solo and QT Marshall as a last thought was a Tony Khan decision. But, you know, that worked as well for what it was. I get a bit of a kick out of the QT Marshall and Aaron Solo stick from what I've seen of them on New Japan Strong.
Hey, QT Marshall was really busting out some of, like, as you probably remember, some of the very old, was it old school QT Marshall moves?
Space like flying tiger drop.
He needs to stop it. Like that, like you get away with that once, but like it was scarily close to the kind of ring apron. But it was fun. It's not like watching the buy-in was a drag and you weren't they managed to get the kind of pace of it right. It's probably helped for you staying up and going into the show that this stuff was, it was good. It kind of was over relatively quickly. And then it sort of got you nicely warmed up without burning you out on anything going up into the main show.
It was the perfect buy-in, you know, pace-wise, and, you know, we didn't waste half an hour on, you know, not much happening. It was all action, and yeah, if people were on the fence thinking, don't know if I'm going to buy this based on the build, you got from that hour an idea of, one, the lads were up for it, two, the crowd were up for it, and three, this was feeling like, you know, despite everything, it was going to be a special show. And yeah, that continued into the main show, which kicked off with, you know, canny political mind Chris Jericho talking his way into an opening match featuring Eddie Kingston once again. But, you know, smart, because Jericho, Guevara, and Suzuki against Kingston, Yuta, and Ubino was the opener. And fuck me, did this pay-per-view as you know, distilled into a match. Blew away all expectations. Like, they couldn't have had a worse, you know, set up for the match. You know, Jericho hammering through exposition on that episode of Dynamite, you know, introducing new characters like Shota Umino with for some reason he got to choose, he was on Eddie Kingston's team. It was all very weird and rushed. For some reason he was teamed with Minoru Suzuki. For some reason Sammy Guevara was in the match and you know, not maybe possibly slightly more suitable member of Jericho's faction than Daniel Garcia. But despite all of that, despite the random nature of the match, they went out there and fucking killed it. Like, this was awesome. I absolutely loved this as an opener. I went 4 stars on it. Thought, you know, everybody had their working boots on. Where the fuck was this Shota Umino in Rev Pro? You know, he looked twice the wrestler he's ever looked there. Part of that was the fact that it felt like, you know, with Jericho, I'm sure it was him that put a word in to get the footage shown of him beating up Red Shoes and slapping Shota from that Wrestle Kingdom 12, was it? Back 14. From that Wrestle Kingdom year where that took place. Like, he decided to create his own little mini story, which I might have maybe enjoyed, you know, explaining on the TV in the weeks leading up as to why Shota was in this match. But for whatever reason, Jericho just decided, okay, you know, I got on with your dad or whatever, or I knew your dad, so I'm going to put you over, kid. And he spent half the match giving Shota like these genuinely credible near falls and taking all these big bumps for him, and he made him look like a $1 million. I thought it was fantastic. I thought Eddie Kingston was brilliant in the match. His little back and forth with Jericho and, you know, Minoru Suzuki, which I would have loved to have seen even more of in the match. Yeah. Sammy Guevara, who felt like a spare part, you know, as far as the announcement goes and as far as fitting into this match, he made sure he had his little moments to shine with his, you know, with his high flying and dives and stuff. And yeah, it was just chaos for, you know, almost 20 minutes, molten crowd, you know, the perfect opener. Absolutely love this.
Yeah, absolutely. And they gave it time to breathe, like gave this nearly 20 minutes. And that helped. Normally you'd be thinking, right, opening with a 20-minute match, is it going to drag? And it didn't, because there were so many moving parts, but it did, it worked. I just was shocked that the person, I was expecting myself to come in like Eddie Kingston as being like the kind of story of the match, but no, you're right. It's like Shota Umino, which seems incredible when I think of all the matches I've seen him here in Rev Pro, and I've just gone, oh, Christ, here he is. Just looks like budget Tanahashi. And like, no, here he was kind of on. I think he means more because of like that Moxley connection, whereas within Rev Pro, that isn't something that's really necessarily played up. So he's, you know, New Japan Young Lion on excursion. But yeah, there was like, I loved the kind of various interactions on this. Jericho felt like he was absolutely on it. They, like you say, everyone got a chance to kind of get their shit in, get their shine. And yeah, it worked. Like, I felt Wheeler Yuta getting much more of a sort of bigger response from that crowd as well. I was a bit shocked they put in the stipulation, and it seemed like inevitable who was going to win at that point. And again, I hadn't realised this in the build up that it was.
I think the last minute, a Rampage, yeah, or after Rampage, I think. Yeah,
right.
But then it's the right result, isn't it? The heels go over, and then
the right result
have the advantage, you know, for War Games. That's the way it should work. The one thing I was going to say, I thought you were going to say you were shocked at, was that Jericho was in there with Wheeler doing their Benoit tribute spots on the anniversary of 2007. You know, the Germans and stuff. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but
yeah.
And then the cross
face afterwards. Yeah.
It got over, but I don't think people were putting two and two together, but I wondered if that was on purpose. But yeah, it was great. It's a lot of fun, and yeah, I went 4 stars. What did you give it? I went 4 stars on it. It's
oh, 4 stars.
Yeah, trending on the app of 4.02, so we're pretty much dead on. It was, yeah, in the end, the perfect way to kick this card off. So yeah, eat a little bit of a crow on that, because it was not a match I was looking forward to one bit. But in the end, the parts were better than the sum. I can't remember what analogy we used on the weekend show, but yeah, definitely a surprise to me. And yeah, the hits kept on coming, because after that we went into the three-way tag match, Roppongi Vice, United Empire and FTR. I've got a feeling you might be a bit higher than me on this one. I liked it, but maybe not as much as the grapple average is saying. I went 3.5, and the average is 3.79 on the app at the minute, maybe trending more towards 4 stars. It was at last look. Maybe that's toned down a little bit now. But what did you make of this one? I think for me, the thing that maybe took me out of it a little bit, actually, before I get to that, I will say, love FTR. Like, after this babyface run of FTR, just, they feel like the two of the biggest stars on the roster. That music hits, and there's just a changing mood, you know, in the arena. It's that, it's the gear, it's the way they present themselves now as babyfaces. FTR should not work this well, but fuck me, it does. Absolutely love them in the match. Didn't love the injury spot. I know people were into that, but I don't know. It was like, I think you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And when you do that, because you can either, you know, it didn't really go on long enough for, you know, for... which was not, was it Dax who got taken out?
Yeah.
FTR here was left on his own. Let's go with that. He was left on his own, not really for that long, so it wasn't really like it was this great moment when his partner came back, or he was in particularly any kind of strife. I mean, the crowd bought it like that, and it got a great pop on the night, and many a worker will tell you that's all that really matters. But I don't know, I kind of feel like to sell it more, you need to take longer, but then you do end up in Cody territory, don't you, where it's you know, almost a detriment to the match. Just a weird spot to do, considering it was a work and wasn't a legitimate injury. But that aside, you know, a lot of fun work in the match. Roppongi Vice were there for the exact reason we thought they were, to eat the pin. But a nice surprise to see FTR go over, and yeah, now they're both ROH Tag Team Champions and the New Japan Tag Team Champions. So I think there's a lot of fun possibilities of what you can do with them coming out of this.
Yeah, and they've waited a long time, haven't they? Because like, they joined AEW during COVID. You could tell, being the kind of wrestlers they are, obviously, they're going to win the IWGP titles, and they'd imagine they'd want to win it properly, like in Japan at like a big show or something along those lines. But I'm with you. I went 3.5 stars, and it was primarily like, I really enjoyed, like, I thought it was a lot of fun during the match again. And it was again, another match that kind of over delivered, but still had the kind of room to breathe. But like you, this is where we talk about the crowd kind of willing this on, because they were great with the injury angle and stuff like that. And then when he came back out, they popped big, and that kind of made it mean something. But like, I thought, like, I won't lie, I don't quite understand why they're as popular as what they are. Like, I don't know where, how this is kind of built up to be this way, because they were doing promos about themselves as families, and now they seem like to be completely beloved. And I'm still kind of quite not sure how it's happened. And I don't have an issue with it, obviously. But that was the thing that slightly took me out of it. I have to say, I'm really enjoying Jeff Cobb. I generally enjoy Jeff Cobb and Great O'Khan as a tag team. You know, I mean, if this is like a few, something becomes like a bit of a feud they end up doing in Japan on a couple of big shows, and I'm fine with this being one of their kind of two sort of big show deals where they have matches and they'll trade the titles and the rest of it, I'm kind of generally fine with that. And I thought like Roppongi Vice were fine, and they didn't kind of like stink up the place. And again, it generally flew by, and this was another, like, you know, 16 minute match as well to kind of start off the show. But it just felt like you weren't shortchanged by anyone in these first two matches. And we'll talk about it for the third match as well, where you've got all these kind of big parts, but everyone is given time. And that was a really important thing. And it didn't feel like the end of the previous Dynamite, where there's like three separate angles going on as two men stare at each other uncomfortably for 2 minutes.
I think that can be a dangerous game, though, with an AEW preview, because we have sat here and moaned about them running too long, which was my worry at the start of this, that when they were given, the negative of giving that much time to the opener be going almost 20 minutes, felt like, oh no, was that going to be the pace for tonight? There can be a negative to that, I think. But
I think if you've got this many wrestlers, this crowd, and kind of some unique interactions, you can get away with it on this kind of a card, I think, as an exhibition and possibly one-off event. New Japan can blow very hot and cold on these things when it comes to relationships with companies. So whether or not I would still hold doubt on there being a second one for whatever reasons. But like, it still made this like a lot of fun, because again, it wasn't like feeling like you were putting out like an exhibition match out there for sort of 15 minutes, like, because there was a lot of action. And I'm not mad on these many kind of multi-mans at the start of a show, but on this particular card, it worked for the whole concept of the show.
It was kind of that, what we undersaw was that just the novelty of, okay, yes, yeah, would we rather see, Suzuki versus Kingston, or would we rather see, some of these lads who are buried in six bands in prestigious singles matches? Yes. But we kind of forgot that maybe the novelty of just seeing these people interact in the first place, and the crowds were well up for just seeing that, and just seeing, these characters that you might not see in the same ring or in the same show do that. Before we move on, I was going to say, I meant to mention it there on the previous match. I'll throw in a big plug for Will, by the way. Will did a really good article on why you think on Fan Fight, which I believe he's joined now, and why he thinks Eddie Kingston should have been the new AEW interim champion. So yeah, check that out, folks, if you haven't already. There you go, Phil. There's your plug, mate.
That'll be a point that I'll also be, well, I say homage to it, I'll be stealing for the when we do a state of the AEW one about directions to go in and characters to go behind. But yeah,
Carl says here in the chat as well, he'd love to see stats on how many AEW pay-per-view matches have gone less than 10 minutes. There you go. Put that. Grapple Gareth, get those stats together for us for the 6 month year in review. We'll chat that. Moving on into another match another multiple person match, but a four way this time. Pac Miro, Malakai Black, and Clark Connors, who he gave a promo to kind of get his character over. Don't know how well he did with that, but he did his best. Bless him, did Clark. His tan was fucking impressive. It was, late 2000s Shawn Michaels level as the tan that lad had on him. He was quite the sight. And to be honest, like, I didn't really understand why or how, But he kind of became like a bit of a folk hero in this match with the other lads in there. You know, I think maybe the crowd took to him as like this underdog who, you know, you couldn't possibly expect to win here. So they kind of latched onto as their guy. You know, he had a couple of fun big spots in the match. You know, they gave him that big spear through the table on the outside when all three of the other lads were trying to hit moves there, and he was the one who got it. You know, they did a good job of giving him those little individual moments, even if, you know, from the start he was again clearly there to take the fall. That's another thing on this show. You know, one thing that you definitely say is that I think I don't think we got any of the predictions for the finishes wrong on this one, because it was all pretty much paint by numbers, wasn't it? But you know, that's what he was there, lowest man on the totem pole there to do. And I thought the four of them had a full match. Again, I would probably have rather seen a singles match with any of these parts. Again, I think I may be slightly lower than the average. I went 3.5 on this one as well. The average for this sitting at 3.89 on Grapple, so near a four. People seem to absolutely love this, but I don't know, maybe for me there's just a bit of a ceiling on a four-way match. Don't know about you.
I could see your point. I went 3.75, so I was slightly higher, probably more in tune with the average. Again, this was like, sorry to be really boring with this, but it over-delivered. It was for a title that was
hang on, can I just correct you? Will said in the chat, it was for a stupid match for a stupid title. And Connors was the only person the Google crowd wasn't pissed off for not being in a real match, so they went for him. That's Will's explanation on it. So, yeah.
Well, stupid match I also for a think stupid as title. Well, the crowd likes Pac. The crowd likes Miro. And Miro, again, if he's going to be there for a sustained period of time and avoid injury, someone you want to have up around that main event scene, frankly. Stop having him tread water. If you're going to use him, fucking use him, which will also become a theme of this, about like, just go for it, perhaps with some of these guys. And I think because Clark Connors was like the unknown quantity in this, and he was smaller, but the crowd likes him. They love Aleister Black, Malachi Black as well, and the entrance. So it felt like he was unique. He was just like the kind of different component into it as well. And I mean, I think, you know, given the situation, like he really elevated himself, like to be able to kind of, you know, working that kind of a crowd in there with people who are all like recognizable faces, have had like kind of quite long WWE, you know, have all had WWE runs in their sort of past, where, and Clark Connors is like a, you know, he's only really out of the dojo, what, sort of year, 18 months, like hasn't worked these kind of size of crowds as well. And it, again, rather like Shota Umino, it sort of became the story of the match in its own way. However, like, if we're going to go in, where does it go after this? So like I went 3.75 on the match. I thought there was like a lot of fun, a lot of like kind of really good spots, and everyone again was able to kind of get their stuff in. This is, where do we go afterwards now? We've got another title in the mix. It feels like, is this going to become a kind of work rate title? Because in which case, what the fuck is the TBS title? Is that the soap opera title? You know, and then the world title means more. Do you know what I mean? It's like, where do we go from here?
TNT belt could have absolutely been that, couldn't it? Should we just merge them? Yeah. Let's just do a merger as soon as possible.
Just do merge.
I thought maybe on the back of this, they might announce like a Craven Cottage show. Maybe Pac's got the belt for a reason.
Yeah.
There could be something to that.
He's a Brit to have with the belt, and he's like the best of what they have.
The one thing I would say as well with Clark Connors is like, I don't know. It feels like it's a bit like, and this is a weird analogy, but you know when you watch like a film like, I don't know, Kiddletood or Attack the Block or a film like that where, you know, when they'll cast like real kids as actors. No matter whether they're good, they're bad or terrible, the talking point is always, oh, you know, they cast real kids and how good were they? Like, it's almost like a thing you've got to say. Like, there's no situation where anyone watches one of those films and go, they were terrible, you know, they couldn't act. Like, and it's like, I mean, Clark Connors, he got over, so, you know, there's job done on the night. Felt like it was a bit of like he was over for ironic reasons rather than real reasons. I'm with you. Like, what happens after this with him? Like, I don't know what if this will ever be capitalized on him, or I'll be honest, like I can't imagine seeing Clark Connors ever again in AEW or anytime soon in AEW, or even, you know, in a major position in New Japan. I don't know. I just think it's that shit people say. You know, he was, because he was the young lad in the match, because the crowd kind of chose him as a favorite, that he was like some kind of, it was some kind of star-making performance here. I don't think it was. I think he was just, he was a body in a match. I feel like I pumped the brakes on the expectation for him.
Realistically, his position is a slightly more prominent position in the New Japan Juniors. That's like really the best case scenario, given the size, given how he works as well. He offers like a, I think, like a kind of new and interesting dynamic. And I've seen loads of his matches at this point. So sat through so many of his matches as a young
lion.
What's
his potential?
Like New Japan's strong. I mean, if his potential is quite high, certainly from like sort of becoming as an in-ring performer. He's still in the way of kind of finding himself. So, like, that's why he has that kind of renegade, you know, Lorenzo Lamas style look that he has going for him with the wild rhino and the hair. I personally think he's one of the people that you'd want to have as one of your pillars of the junior division post Hiromu, post Despy, which is what they should be doing now. And he'd be the guy from the LA Dojo to bring across. And I think he'd be the kind of person you'd see him making his name in Japan. Like, there's always, like, obviously, like, a certain, you might imagine there's more of a size limitation for him would probably rule out, say, like, a WWE interest and whatnot. But I've always enjoyed his work. It's just that quite often when he's in there with kind of people you think of as, like, kind of big stars, and this is, like, the first time, and he didn't get overawed. Like, that's a really, like, important thing. You've got people
didn't embarrass
a lot of... No, not at all as well. But realistically, where did New Japan go with him? They're not going to be putting him in a world title scene or anything else. It's what you're hoping for at best is for them to go, okay, this is someone who, like, there is value in them. The work is up to the required level. An extended stay in Japan and, like, kind of build them as, like, their proper, you know, their foreign babyface junior.
I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see what comes next with him. But yeah, you know, give the lad credit, you know, as much as, you know, I'm maybe a little bit cooler on his potential just based on, you know, it is just based on that match pretty much. You know, he got over and, you know, and he didn't, you know, look out of place with the other three in there. So that's probably as much as you can expect. We all would have preferred Ishii in the match. We all probably would have preferred, you know, somebody as a name, as a substitute. But, you know, he's the one people are talking about. So right or wrongly, it has definitely worked out for him and up the stock even a little bit. But moving on from there, talking the word fun, which is the word of this podcast, JP. We went to the match of the Young Bucks and El Fantasma against the Dudes with Attitudes of Sting, Darby, and Shingo. Still a fucking weird sentence. And this is the one where, yeah, we were talking about in the preview. It's kind of like, rather see Shingo in a singles, rather see Hiromu versus Darby when it looked like it was going to be an eight man, rather see Darby versus Shingo, rather see the Young Bucks versus Shingo and Hiromu. But with all that said, you know, what did we say? It'll, you know, you throw Sting in there, you throw this wacky group of lads in there, it's probably going to be a lot of fun. It's probably, if not going to steal the show, going to be one of the most memorable matches on the show. And it was exactly that. It really was. It was just exactly what you wanted from all of these characters kind of mixing together from the top with, you know, Sting hitting that dive off the stage where, fuck me, did it, like, that looked, Darby's talking him into this stuff, at some point Sting's gonna get hurt, but fuck me, is it cool to watch the fact that he's even up to it, you know, at his age. The man's in his 60s,
62,
and he's willing to do this. I mean, Scott Norton's,
I'll,
like,
check that.
I think he's 64, is he not? I saw Scott Norton had a birthday this week and he was the same age, and good lord, did he not look as good as Sting on that New Japan Strong show we saw recently.
63. The difference.
Fucking honest to God, like, he was great. All of the interaction between everyone in here was just a complete laugh. It was just Yeah, it was exactly what we thought it would be. Young Bucks and El Fantasma had, you know, good chemistry as far as being, you know,
yeah,
dickhead heels, you know, doing that daft back rig spot that, you know, does get a little bit of a chuckle out of me. Young Buck, you know, their reintroduction to Bullet Club, you might have expected to be with mm-hmm. in a more heavy duty situation, but they were hamming it up, even wearing the old jackets. But yeah, loads of memorable moments in this, just highly entertaining from start to finish. And yeah, it was just, you know, Shingo was there too. So this is the only point I'd make. Although it was cool to see him and Sting exchanging an LIJ yeah. fist bump. So, you know, again, not the idealistic use of Shingo, but just the idea of him and Sting being a team was almost worth the price of admission here.
I think as well with this is it's the Sting show. That was the whole time I was watching this. I grew with the idea of the recent Shingo run in New Japan and how he was on this show. They're very much saving him for the G1. There must be a lot of wear and tear and a lot of the kind of big main events that he ends up doing. And let's face it, he'll be doing a lot of main event spots during this G1 run as well. So he'll be doing plenty of work. This Sting run has had absolutely no right to be as good as it was. If I told you we were going to get a Sting run in AEW, now how long has he been there? So it's over a year, isn't it? It's Christ.
Oh, yeah, it's 2 years now, I think.
Nearly 2 years. Fucking hell. And he hasn't taken the pin from anyone. Like, you'd think we'd be going batshit, wouldn't we, about this? And thinking, well, this is just like TNA again. But the tone of this run is so much fun. Like, and I predict he'll only lose to one person, and that'll be in Darby Allin, and that'll be his retirement match. And that'll be it. And he'll go off into the sunset. And we'll talk about this run as like one of the great kind of elder wrestler swan song runs that had no right, considering the idea of him wrestling. And he's doing, Christ, he only did that dive through a load of tables on Andrade like the other month. There's no way he should be doing this stuff. And you're right, there was distance he was traveling to as well. But yeah, if, you know, we're a podcast synonymous with fun. And wrestling fun in particular, aren't we?
That's always hate everything.
Well, same here. USP. Like, this was the textbook definition of it as well. I mean, even stuff like, you know, him doing a nipple twist on ELP and the rest of it, and no selling ELP.
He forgot spot though, didn't he? Like, he went to the I think this was after, because Darren mentions in the chat like a memorable spot was, you know, when he no-sold the double super kick and, you know, clothesline yeah. the box. I think he was supposed to do something with LP, so LP did like the slow turner on, like, oh no, Sting's gonna be there, and Sting had got off, he got out the other side of the ring, he'd forgot the spot was coming, so he rolled back in and then did it with, you know, whatever. He's Sting, he can get away with it, he's a living legend. And yeah, he's doing, you know, bumps that he probably shouldn't be doing at his age, but okay, yeah, he's up for it, and he's enjoying it, and it's an all-timer of a run. It's just so great to see. Absolutely love him. Simon says here, fun dad Sting. That's exactly what he is in this role, and it's everything he should be.
Absolutely.
But yeah, moving on
it's pitch perfect.
Last year. Yeah, moving on from there, Thunder Rosa and Toni Storm came up next, the AEW women's title. Yeah, this was a match that definitely felt like it was a bit out of the blue. I know Toni Storm said in interviews that, you know, the ideal would have been, you know, something with Stardom. Tony Khan said in the post-show presser that they did look into that, but there were visa reasons, and I think the people they wanted sounded like they were booked up for other stuff. So we ended up with this, and it did feel a little bit out of place. It felt a little bit like that match where, and I kind of experienced it when I was at AEW shows live over the last while, you know, in Vegas and LA, that like it did feel like almost like a holdover from the Attitude Era, that anytime the women hit the ring, the concession stands filled up, and this felt like it happened again. I was kind of noticing in that more now, even you know, the year that we're in, that's still maybe the Attitude, maybe the fact that it was, again, you know, not really a proper New Japan versus AEW match. Maybe it was a match that should have been elsewhere, added to that. So probably the coolest the crowd had been up to this point. I just thought it was pretty well done professional wrestling match. Thunder Rosa went over. Not much more to say. 3-star special. It was, you know, you see a lot of that from Toni Storm, but, you know, I expected maybe a little bit more in the spot, considering how good I thought she's looked on TV for the last while.
Well, you see, this match didn't have spectacle compared to the other ones. It felt like a run-of-the-mill AEW match. And the others at least had the interactions. They'd been booked in a way we were being given lots of kind of big moments and everything else. And this just didn't have it. And I think as a result, it became very much the cool-down match. Now, I went 3.25 because I actually thought I quite liked some of the work between them as well. Kind of a bit of the issue was it felt quite definitive at the end, like in terms of Thunder Rosa winning. And I know we were very much saying like Thunder Rosa will win. And I suspect part of the reason for this is that Toni Storm might be going to Stardom. I don't know if she'll be doing the 5-star Grand Prix. I don't know if they've announced who's going to be in that, or certainly at some point she'll be doing some kind of tour.
You could have told that story though, do you not think? Could have like, you know, made that part of the gimmick here that actually she's representing Stardom.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's where we get into the complicated politics of it. But we don't know really what are the politics between Stardom and Tokyo Joshi Pro. Is there going to be that kind of offence taken to it as well? You know what it's like, Ibi. You know, these are sort of quite arcane relationships. Ask about the CMLL one proves all of that and the kind of nonsense that is as well. But yeah, it felt like, I don't know, it felt like a match that was very much kind of like lost in the shuffle for it, but I didn't think it was bad. It didn't like stink up the place or anything else. It was fine, but it was just noticeably a lot cooler. And I just think because it wasn't something that kind of felt part of the show and the tempo and the mood of the show. It wasn't the kind of match that the crowd are going to be thinking, this will be really great fun. Do you know what I mean? I think they like, for this crowd, it didn't really have that.
A bit out of place. I would definitely say with that one. And yeah, what did you give it as a grapple rating?
3.25.
The average is trending at 3.27. So yeah, pretty much dead on there. But moving into the business.
You didn't mention one thing. Oh. They're going back to Arthur Ashe.
Oh, that was that here? Where that going? I'm already looking at
flights. Yeah, just mate. Before this match. I was going to say, I take it neither of us are going to this one. I'll be back in work at that point.
Oh, no, I've already looked. I think I'll be doing it. Some little deals you can get me. You're willing to fly via Norway, you can get to New York for about 300 quid. So I'm already looking at the thing. I sell my old phone for 100 quid, you know, do some overtime and work. I could get me £150 back from the government for my electricity bill. I could possibly make it for this one. I was hoping to actually do it in combination with All Out, but I don't think that's going to be possible. All Out's way too early in the month. I think definitely something I want to do when I get back to New York. So hoping to make the trip out.
Built to an Eddie Kingston title match. That'd be the story I'd be doing going into that one.
Do Will's article, but with the proper title. Maybe that's where we're going. So we went on from there into Orange Cassidy and Will Ospreay and the business. End of the card here. You know, I think Ospreay Orange Cassidy was definitely a touch point match as much as anything. This felt the match that was maybe the most divisive on this card for a lot of us who were trying to determine whether we were looking forward to this or not. I would say that, like, for me, I wanted to. Sorry, I've got the. Let me just turn that off.
Is that Orange Cassidy calling you there to go be fucking careful what you say?
It might be somebody who's currently in Chicago. I will get that in a minute. Yes, Orange Cassidy and Will
Ospreay. They're on the air. She was there.
I'll just say on air. There we go. Orange Cassidy. I should have got her. I should have patched her in. Maybe she could give us the live review here. Orange Cassidy and Will Ospreay. Anyway, I'll ring back in a minute. It was. You know, the match that I think a lot of us, you know, if you were looking at a dream match, would I book Will Ospreay versus Orange Cassidy? No. You know, I think as we laid out on Spotlight and on the preview show, realistically 15 more options on the AEW roster that I'd rather put in there with Will Ospreay. I, at the same time, you know, I'm kind of done with the Orange Cassidy gimmick. It's just, it's not like I hate it. I'm not like Jim Cornette or it's exposing the business or whatever. I just kind of, you know, oh yeah, okay, he's lazy. Or as the commentary was put in here, oh, it's a head fuck. It's a mind game he's trying to do with his opponents here with the slow kicking and stuff. However you want to explain it, I'm just bored of it, you know. And this match was nothing different than what I thought, because I knew once we got past that 5 minutes of doing the Orange Cassidy nonsense, we were going to get 15 minutes of a sprint of the fire that Orange Cassidy has. You know, as Fire Ant, he was one of my favorite baby faces on the indies at one point, because literally it was in the name. He had that baby face fire. You know he's got that level in him. We know it from the PAC match. So it wasn't a surprise that they went out there and killed it. It was just, you know, I mean, it's Will Ospreay in a focus match. You could probably put him up against anybody in the AEW roster and you're probably getting at least a 3.5 to 3.75 star match. But, you know, Orange Cassidy is no slouch, and this was I'd probably go 4.25 star matches. Again, not a shock, really. You know, I would have preferred to see Ospreay with somebody where I might have gone 4.5 or 5 stars, maybe. Would I prefer him in, you know, Kenny Omega's been doing press this last week or so, where he's been putting over the idea of kind of basically been burying Will Ospreay, but he's been putting over Jay White and using it as a way to stick the oar in with Ospreay. That's a match that they're clearly building to down the line, I think, at some point. You know, obviously it wasn't available here. That's more the level of a match I think Ospreay should be in at this point. But did it deliver? Was it very good? Yes. And I think the grapple rating says everything on this one, because it's sitting there trending more towards like 4.5 stars at this point. This one, it's doing particularly well on the app, 4.38 on the app. And I don't know where do you land, JP? Mm.
Well, I mean, that puts it in very much match of the night territory for it. I went 4.25 as well. And I think towards the end, this was like really cracking. It was almost, this for me was like, okay, this is the best kind of match that you're going to be able to get with Orange Cassidy. That's as like almost as this is as good as we're going to get. I don't know if it was just me. Is he dropped a lot of muscle since the last time he was there as well? I mean, maybe it might just be me, but he looked like, it felt like before he was away, that was the case. And like a lot of the things you've said as well, where this is like another match that kind of over-delivered. I think Ospreay was just determined to go out and go, right, now I'm going to have like a match that's going to really get over with this crowd. He's just going to go out there and do it. And he did as well. And, you know, a lot of his shtick, which, you know, stuff that, you know, we kind of don't really enjoy as much within the UK, it gets over here as well. Like I say, I think there was some like sort of like really sort of lovely counters as well at various points, and when Orange Cassidy shows those bits where he can do some wrestling as well. And I got like surprisingly into this. I didn't expect to. And I went 4.25. Even the stuff with after the match, I mean, we worked out where Aussie Open were being on the card, who I have to say, if there's other people who are big winners of this, it's like this unheralded New Japan talent, of which we're talking about Clark Connors, Shota Umino, and Aussie Open, who haven't wrestled like really in New Japan proper, unless we're talking about the show at the Copper Box. I don't know if you remember, they had a tag match against the Gorillas of Destiny. So, you know, they had that in there as well. But yeah, I thought this was a hell of a lot of fun.
Did you believe Orange Cassidy was ever going to win?
No, that's the problem. And it's building to a weird dynamic of, like, kind of Ospreay and Juice Robinson, where you're kind of, well, who's the baby face meant to be? Because it just feels more like kind of stable warfare. That is an issue. I think on this type of a card where you're looking at unique interactions, you can kind of say, all right, I don't necessarily, like, in the main event, I didn't believe Tanahashi was going to beat John Moxley. It's still, at times, you can get past that and not like be as bothered, but it's the kind of thing that's going to take it out of the kind of high end range, like your 4.5 and 4.75, because you haven't got the element of doubt. But considering what I was expecting from this match, I was much more into it than I expected to be.
I was about the level I expected to be. Didn't expect it to be bad. Mm. Expected it to be about this good. Expected Ospreay to, you know, work well with the Orange Cassidy shtick. You know, Will's kind of saying that in the chat here, that it wasn't much of a clash of styles, because Ospreay's kind of always game for that kind of stuff. Can't hugely disagree with that. I think, like I say, the only thing was, I don't think Ospreay and Cassidy are, in my mind, on in equal points in the roster for either company, although, you know, clearly Tony Khan sees Orange Cassidy as near that level rather than as maybe the lower card comedy act that maybe I peg him as in my brain. It's a tough one because it's like, you know, it doesn't turn into a thing on the character, like, because I think it's over, it draws ratings, you know, Orange Cassidy kind of has to do this role now, but I think inherently there are limits to what you can do with it. You know, it is, for all intents and purposes, a kind of a lighthearted relief character, and you can get these moments of shine where, you know, it's hard to do this character consistently and have him constantly, you know, okay, but on this match, he's not going to be lazy guy. On this match, he's actually going to, you know, bring it. You can only do that so many times a year, I think. And that's the, you know, the negative of a character that is, you know, so over because it's, you know, it is what it is. It's a meme that got over on the indies and, you know, ended up working surprisingly well on TV with the key demos that AEW has. So, yeah, you know, worked well. And I would say the thing that it really worked for it, yeah, you mentioned there, the post-match in that, yeah, we got a surprise appearance of Katsuhiro Shibata. Kind of wasn't, I was expecting somebody to make the save. Yeah, I was kind of going through my brain, okay, who from my friends isn't around? Yano was in the country, yeah, maybe it would have been him. Maybe that was plan A, and then they were like, oh, you know, we'll get a better pop, Shibata. I mean, he's got fuck all to do with Ospreay or, you know, United Empire or the best friends or any of the shit going on, but it made for a nice moment, fun interaction between him and Orange Cassidy, and about, you know, everybody in that crowd is going to remember where they were when, you know, that music hit and they got that really cool moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really what this was. And if you think about it, like, all of the kind of the matches that had worked up to this point had kind of like these kind of big moments happening within them. If we're thinking about the like the Sting dive, for example, or, you know, thinking back to the kind of the big sort of table spot with Clark Connors, and, you know, we'd had some like kind of really sort of big notable stuff, and this was like the first time. Well, it was I mean, this crowd did two very big pops within quick succession of each other, but this was one of the ones where it was kind of unexpected. And the fact that Shibata is clearly like, he's coming back like kind of proper. I'm of the opinion the reason why he's in the US is there's going to be more scope for medical treatments that he's going to be able to get that will hopefully get him back to the ring. I don't know, things like stem cell research and the like. And I think that's why he's in the States. I think that's it kills two birds with one stone. And I expect, if you'd said to me he'd be in a pose down with Orange Cassidy, I'd be all prepared to hate it and shit on it. The crowd, like, again, because the crowd were kind of into it, and because it isn't the kind of stuff you see all of the time, it kind of worked. If he'd done the thumbs up, that would have been an issue. But him just sort of stood there.
I wish he had, to be honest. I was missing that moment, I thought. It was kind of awkward when they tried to cut to a video package for the next match, and it was like, he got Orange Cassidy back in the ring. I felt like that's what it needed, you know, that nice little...
Yeah.
That photo op of the two of them doing the thumbs up. He was having a good time, so whatever. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Went from there into the next big match of the night, and they wasted no time. They sent Zach out there, and then it wasn't like Brian came out and made the big introduction, or they let it, you know, sit for a few seconds, just some really shite music hit. The crowd went mental because I think they worked it out immediately. I don't know whether it was, there was a big screen that I think there was. That
there was a big Swiss flag, I think, like the white cross was on the
kind of frustrating the screen, that production weren't showing.
Which we couldn't see.
Yeah, you know, because the crowd were going mental, so they knew. So, like, you know, clue the rest of us in, although we all really knew. And yeah, out walked Claudio Castagnoli. You know, it was... one of them, probably predictable, but predictable is good here. I think he was the only acceptable answer to who the Brian replacement was, especially when, you know, they told that story of it being a Brian choice. And apparently Tony Khan was saying in the scrum, it was a legitimate Brian choice in real life, and Brian wasn't aware that apparently Claudio signed to AEW or agreed to sign in early June. And Tony was saying some talk of maybe using him in the newfangled ROH before this opportunity came up. So a bit of uncharacteristic patience from Tony there, waiting a month before using a guy. I think didn't quite fit in with, you know, I know Garrett said this before, you know, sign some guys and put them on ice for 6 months, not everyone needs to debut at once, but you know, waited a month before bringing him in, and can't argue with it. You got an absolutely huge response. He looked made up to be out there, you know, yeah. And went out there with Zach and adds what, you know, is it a AEW versus New Japan dream match? Maybe not really, but was it a dream match for a lot of wrestling fans? Absolutely. And yeah, I thought they delivered a very good match. It wasn't, you know, one of my favorites of the night, but it was very good. It was cool to see Claudio kind of work off, I don't know if the ring rust is the word. I felt like he was selling, like he spent a lot of the match kind of heavy breathing and, you know, acting like he was blown up, but I don't think he was. I think it was definitely part of the work, and he was selling Zack Sabre's offense, if anything. But yeah, lots of silky smooth interactions in there, lots of cool spots where we got to see the power of I keep wanting to say Claudio. Should get back to mid. Needs to bring back the needs to steal that theme back off. Of Tyler Bate. We need to go back to proper Claudio. ROH coming out with a $1 million man style jacket, Claudio. Maybe that's what we need to stick this back in my memory. But a lot of, like, I felt like there were a lot of throwback spots in this, including the what does he call that powerbomb? Someone will tell me in the chat in a minute. I'm a bad mid-2000s indie fan for forgetting the name of it. But
that where he puts the arm traps. Yeah, I can't think of the
Cool to see him, you know, bust that out as his AEW finisher, presumably, and it felt like the right result too. You know, Zach was, you know, you can't really argue. You know, Claudio's going to be going into Blood and Guts on Wednesday. Ricola, there you
Ricola.
Go, Ricola bomb. So we got that. But yeah, Zach's, you know, can't really argue. I think you have to put Claudio over here with the Blood and Guts on Wednesday, and it's the big debut, and you know, Zach and Brian will happen at a later day, and we'll all forget that he lost to Claudio. So I think it was a good bit of business all around. Whether Claudio is the dog that was bought for Christmas or not, as the analogy we put on the weekend show, whether he'll go in that big box of Tony's toys and you know, be forgotten about after, you know, probably we'll get a month of focus, and then, you know, where is he in the grand scheme of things in 2 months might be the question. But I don't know, maybe he's in safer hands than some of the recent debuts, given he's in Blackpool Combat Club, and there's, you know, there's always the multi-mans you can do with those lads, and he'll probably get, you know, ample screen time from that.
I mean, I think I went 4 stars on this. I thought this was, like, I thought it was very good. I was like, the level of response that he got was great. He felt like a big deal. I immediately thought, if he's coming across this way within the building in the night, like, kind of go with this and start putting him up there as being like somebody who's on the level of a Moxley and a Danielson. Like, just do that. Like, that then becomes the perception of who he is. And I really enjoyed it. I think one of the things I just sort of felt slightly, like, I suppose in a way, is it felt more like this was the showcase for Claudio. I'm going to say Cesaro loads of times as well. And so as a result, Zach is kind of overshadowed in some ways between them. However, I thought this is the kind of match I think we're going to see in New Japan, because I think if there is a place for him where he could really work and get over, just thinking of how he carries himself, how he wrestles, the look, and everything else, it does feel like New Japan would be like a place for him to go to. And if he can have like a sort of return match against Zach in there as well. And like I said, I don't think this hurts like Zack Sabre Jr. at all for it as well. But it was almost like it was the Claudio showcase, but it was the situation they were left in. What were they going to do once Danielson had kind of gone out? And this is almost as given the kind of given the situation that they were in, Freudian slips happening all over the place here, mate, this was as good as they were going to get. And you know, I like you, I, you know, and Simon mentioned in the chat, I don't believe that Claudio can get blown up. I just don't think he can do. He's not. He's just got cardio for years, that guy.
And fucking looks incredible, though, and he still, he's dropped a little bit of weight, but might not necessarily, be a negative too. But yeah, I just want to, I don't know, I thought the music was fucking awful, and I would like Tony Khan to spend that money on Sledgehammer. Come on, let's retcon that from Tyler Bates. It was always Claudio's.
That'll cost a lot, mate, Sledgehammer.
He's got it. He can afford it. Come on. I want it. But yeah, it worked, and it was a great moment for the people there live. And like I said, I'm surprised I'm quite low on it. I really liked it. I went 3.75, the Benno special. But yeah, grapple average at 4.15, trending closer to, you know, a 4.25 star. Where did you go with it?
I went 4 stars.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Which, if you told me at the start of the night, because there wasn't the kind of stakes. And that's the thing that creates a little bit more of drama that's going to make you more emotionally invested. But I still want to see more of these two. I still, you know, it's just, if they are bringing him in, then fuck it. Go shit or bust. Just try and push him like big time. Do that. Like I say, just put him on the level rather than having him fuck about for months at a time, not knowing what to do.
I don't hate him in ROH. You know, that was another thing that got announced in the press scrum. They got a Death by the Sauna pay-per-view coming up in July. And like I say, Claudio's name was thrown around as possibly being an ROH guy. That might be, might be a nice spot for him. Might freshen up that little mini roster they've got over on that side. I guess
if they've got like some sort of distribution deal set up for it, and you're wanting to have kind of like other more familiar faces to have in there, but also the idea is they're going to get to work a lot with younger talent. I mean, he is kind of prime for that, because let's face it, how long is Joe going to be able to kind of wrestle at that level? Whereas like Claudio looks like he's fine to go out there and effectively just start getting himself back in the groove. But there's loads of it. We've said this before, and I kind of almost refuse to get too excited about any AEW signings at this point, because we've kind of seen everyone who can turn up there that kind of can do. Do you know what I mean? It's like, who else is there really at this point?
It's a stake.
When you get Punk out of retirement and fucking Danielson,
they're going to run out of Pops discourse. But no, I know what you mean. Like, there is it's almost sustaining them at this point. It's like, you know, it's the big exciting debut, and then there's another big exciting debut, and we're all whipped up into this constant frenzy's excitement that will run out at some point, you know, as far as guys you can legitimately bring in. Past him, it's Gargano, innit? Then you're scraping the barrel with Bray Wyatt, I think, at some point. But yeah, I guess we'll see. But yeah, moving on from there into our semi-main event, the four-way, Jay White, Adam Cole, Hangman Page, and Okada. Firstly, the positive, I would say Okada came across as the biggest wrestling star in the entire world.
Yeah.
Again, not to beat a dead horse, should have been in a singles match. I don't think there's an excuse not to. I think if you're worried about Hangman taking a loss, I think Hangman maybe need to just take a loss. I just think you could have told a story with that. You know, not turning into full Road Dog, wins and losses don't matter, it's the story you tell. But you can tell a story that would make that work. At the end of the day, you got the biggest wrestling star in the world, and possibly the best wrestler in the world, you know, willing to come in for this show. You want to put him in a prime position. I didn't really like this match. I think the people there live, I think the live reports you're getting were very much wrapped up in we're getting to see Okada live. We've all been there, you know, we're lucky enough to have seen him in the UK multiple times, and it's super cool to see. Maybe it's the fact that it's a four-way. I just don't enjoy the tropes of a four-way. You know, they saved it last minute. Is it the finish? Nowhere comes Adam Cole out of nowhere. We'd already seen that in the previous four-way earlier on in the night. It's not helped by the fact that the finish went to absolute shit, because it looks like, based on a reporting at this point, Adam Cole had a concussion, which is why the finish was basically Jay White gingerly rolling him over and just pinning him. And literally Jim Ross was on commentary saying it was anticlimactic, whatever. But I don't even think it was just that. I just don't think it was that exciting a match, and I don't think Okada seemed up for it being a four-way. I don't know. I'm not saying he was dogging it, but I think you'd have gotten a big match Okada performance elsewhere. Maybe with an extra 5 minutes of near falls, I might not be making that point. You know, that is the point often made about Okada matches, those big near fall sequences and the Jay White, you know, formula, the big reversals. Maybe they were to come and maybe that takes this match up a notch. But I don't know, I thought this card was pretty much perfect right up to this point. You know, a lot of, you know, whether we agree or not on the star rating, basically matches that were 3.5 stars above, you know, across the board. You know, a lot of people have got pretty much everything on this show above 4 stars up to this point, and that's an incredible run. Controversial take, but I think the thing that let this card down a little bit, from me agreeing with the takes out there that it was an all-timer card, was, you know, this and the, I'll get into the main events as well, but primarily this is, I think this was the moment in the cards where you wanted two big deal singles matches, you know, 4.5 star, you know, match of the year contender levels. Is that too much to ask? I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm asking too. No, maybe no. That is a big ask. But you know, you got the two best wrestling companies in the world with the best wrestlers in the world and the possibility to do that. And instead we got this. And yeah, it just felt a little bit underwhelming considering what came before it. But feel free to tell me why I'm wrong.
No, not really. I'm gonna kind of agree with you because I thought there was a point in the match was kind of encapsulated. We'd had the introductions, the crowd. I was loving how much the crowd were into Okada. Then there was a point where Jay White dives out of the ring, Adam Cole dives out of the ring, and we're getting ready to build to a lockup between Okada and Hangman. And I'm there thinking, I'd much sooner be seeing that, this, just these two having an exhibition match, because I think it would be the kind of thing that, you know, would be the idea in some way of Hangman Page shooting for what is generally regarded as one of the best pro wrestlers, certainly of recent years, like, and one of, you know, someone who is comes across as an absolute star. And then it was kind of ruined by having Jay White and Adam Cole put them out of the ring before they could have that kind of interaction. And that's where I kind of found myself slightly zoning out. Now, I didn't think it was bad per se. I mean, in terms of rating, I've gone 3.5, but I was erring around 3.25, if I'm going to be honest with you, because I think there was stuff about the ending that did kind of take me out of it. And then obviously no seeing afterwards.
I think anyone would say, myself included, it was bad, because I'm the same as you. 3.5 stars is not a bad match.
Yeah.
But for a main event on an AEW versus New Japan show with this level of guys in it, it's disappointing.
It is. And this is where we got into the kind of upper, like the issues that we had around the booking and the storytelling to this point, because it's almost like a lot of the other stuff up to there was very much part of the undercard and we were fine with it. And it was over delivering as an undercard and being fun, because shows are meant to have ebb and flow and sort of high points and low and, you know, peaks and troughs and the rest of it, because you're kind of managing people's emotions across it. It's just that this isn't going to be a match that anyone really speaks of as a sort of IWGP title match. What, in a week's time? Like, really? It's a match that happened, but I also thought as well, you put Okada into 4-ways and the rest of it, they're not doing fucking 4-ways like when they're in the dojo and the rest of it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is the kind of stuff. He wasn't even doing it in TNA, because TNA weren't even using him properly.
I believe these, by the way, were the third and fourth 4-way matches in AEW's history. I mean, that tells you something, doesn't it? You know, that something went wrong in the build to this. It's funny because it's
the second one on this card.
And they had a lot to live up to with the incredible card that came before it. It's no slight to say, you know, they maybe didn't slightly live up to it, and maybe that makes it not one of the great wrestling cards of all time. It makes it a pretty fucking great wrestling card, though, you know, and a wrestling card that, you know, will be up there when it comes to the year-end awards and such like. But yeah, I think this was probably my biggest bugbear, really, this match here and this point in the show. But, you know, again, you know, I think the thing they had going against them, which was the curse of this show, it is the Adam Cole injury. I mean, maybe it's easy to say now, but should he have even been out there? You know, I don't really care about wrestler safety. I'm not that guy. But I feel like we had news reports 3 weeks ago that he was going to be out for a while and was injured. And you're seeing like cryptic tweets from Britt Baker and the Young Bucks and people like that talking about, you know, what he gave up to do this match and what a sacrifice he made. It all adds up to maybe he shouldn't have been in there in the first place then, to me, rather than a heroic thing. I don't know. But, bit odd that. I'd be interested to know what the story is there. How, you know, how hurt he was coming in, and I suppose a concussion's something you can't help if that's what it ended up being. But I'm not sure he looked himself anyway in for the majority of the match.
And it's the story, isn't it, about those that always been hinted that there's a lot more people who are injured who need to kind of who need to take a break. To which I say, do you know what? You've got depth in your roster. Like, do you know what? It'd be like Man City complaining about injuries. It's just like, fuck off. You've got loads of money. I'm not accepting the excuse that we haven't got enough players on the bench. Bullshit. Your youth team players cost fucking more than like the some components of like that Nottingham Forest team. So when you've got the roster depth that they have, like I kind of think that there is a point they don't need to needlessly sort of like use people for the sake of it as well. But I wouldn't be disappointed if I had a little break from Adam Cole, which yeah. I know that he's over and everything else, which then I always come back to what the guy just needs to be a baby face. That's how people want to react to him. It's how his act is kind of presented and everything else. He's not a baby face for me, but that's clearly what, like, kind of what he is as well. And then when you throw elite Bullet Club bullshit into the mix that I don't care about, I think that's where I kind of go, I'm not necessarily that bothered of it.
He's in that Tony Khan group of, like I always mentioned there, your Trent, your Orange Cassidy's, your Adam Cole's, the leader of that group of guys that Tony will shoehorn in no matter what. He loves loves the bloke, and maybe he's been a little bit overexposed this first year and lost a lot of big matches. Well, not even a lot of big matches, but he's lost the key big matches, but then continues to be put in, you know, this spot. This, you know, did anyone really believe him as an IWGP champion? Of course not. Maybe he is.
New Japan didn't really seem to care about. I mean, I think the most prominence he had probably in New Japan is when he was wrestling for like defending the Ring of Honor title on like the Tokyo Dome.
Or teaming with
like
Mike Bennett. That was kind of his low level, wasn't it? You know, I mean, that's a few years ago though. You know, it just feels a little bit like if this was a game of EWR, Sophie would be emailing you going, you used Adam Cole too much on the last show. I think that's Tony's getting those emails, but, and they're being unread.
If he is injured and he's been on a lot and he's been one of those people who've been kind of very much like such a heavy part of the TV they've done for a while, if there's a chance of giving them a break, this is where we get into wrestler off-season stuff, which should be happening anyway for like at least 2 months of the year for them, if not to preserve them, to keep them fresh and to give them like a holiday like normal people would be able to have at some stage. Yeah, just some sort of break from fucking work rather than traveling around the country every week.
Well, there we go. So, yeah, that was that. And then we went into the main event. Small matter of John Moxley and Hiroshi Tanahashi to unify the AEW title. Felt like, you know, it was what I expected, really. I went 4 stars on it. Grapple average is 4.09, which is, you know, hardly in match of the year territory, but still a very good match. I think about you know, the level I would expect from, you know, Tanahashi at this point in his career in a Moxley match. Again, to use that word that's been used a lot, fun was what this was always going to be, and it was, you know, there was the fun clash of styles of, you know, Moxley getting bloodied up in this thing, and Tanahashi is, you know, one of the greatest minds in the history of wrestling. He loves to, you know, work in his opponent's style into, you know, his you know, version of wrestling storytelling, and that's what they did here. I think it was maybe, you know, lacking a little bit by the fact that, I don't know, I saw a lot of people doing, you know, flip-flops and hula hoops and, you know, somersaults trying to figure out how, you know, potentially, well, Tanahashi could win because then he'd take the belt to G1 or whatever the justification people were saying. I mean, didn't even give it any consideration. Moxley was always winning. And I think that maybe, you know, hit my personal investment in the match. It didn't, you know, get past that 4-star point for me, maybe partly because of that, partly, you know, I think that was just always the inbuilt seed of the match. It was a nice match that, as we said in the build-up, would have been a great 1B main event to a 1A following it. Imagine if, say, Okada Punk was about to follow this, or, you know, Brian Okada or something like that. You know, obviously, you know, that's an alternate timeline that was never going to take place here. But I don't know, it wasn't quite the killer main event that would have put a real bow on this show. But a 4-star match is a 4-star match, and there was still a lot to like here, JP.
Yeah, I know. I would agree with you. This was what we expected it to be, which was Tanahashi was going to go out there and do his absolute utmost to have a great match. So was Moxley as well. There's like, you know, they were going to do their best between them to deliver on that. And I think hence that's how we ended up with as much blood from Moxley as what we did in terms of just being able to kind of add that drama there as well. It was just that they were never going to put the belt on Tanahashi. I know we had WH on the show a couple of weeks ago. And he was saying, you know, they should put there's an argument to put the belt on Tanahashi.
Oh, was it WH? I was slagging off there. I couldn't remember where I'd heard that point. It was on this podcast, was it? Yeah. Oh, well.
It was.
Sorry, WH.
He said that. And I, but
he's not the only
one. They were never going to do it because of the just the situation of he's, you know, it's an AW title. They're going to put it on an AW guy. That's it. Even if Hiroshi Tanahashi is not going to be the kind of person to take your belt and do a fucking Jeff Jarrett. And just go, yeah, all right, yeah, that rematch's not happening. Bye-bye. And then just leave. He's not going to do anything like that, is he? So, but like you say, I think if you're thinking from like that kind of match quality perspective, the thing, when I think of like the kind of a lot of the great cards that I think about, and, you know, they've always had that pacing, but they've had the kind of real killer in-ring kind of big singles matches with lots of drama and stuff like that. That's really what the double main events kind of lacked, that level of match to kind of take it to that kind of next level for it. As a 1B, like you said before, I'd be absolutely fine with this, but it was never really going to be in doubt for this. However, the crowd loved the chance of getting to see Tanahashi and it's, you know, think of how many times we're going to get to see Tanahashi in big main events. Pretty soon that will be something that won't be happening. And this feels like it'd be one of the last occasions other than when they're going to do the occasional kind of, there'll be the big G1 match he has over the next few years, because I mean, like, it's kind of a mini miracle he gets to this stage and is able to have kind of main event matches as well. And I'd also say about this, it wasn't too long. Like, you know, it was under 20 minutes. As a main, which, you know, I think that's like what large swathes of this card is in around that as well, you know. So it's not something, at least it didn't overstay its welcome. This, even it went straight into the angle afterwards.
Well, I want to say that because I've got a lot of negatives to say about that. Yeah. I want to say on the positive note, I mean, what a breeze the show was to watch. What a fucking,
yeah,
what a great time it was. It felt like it was a celebration of wrestling, is what it felt like. You know, it felt like everyone there was there to have a good time. The wrestlers were there to put their best foot forward, regardless of anything that came before it. And it was just a great time watching wrestling, a great variety show, you know, of wrestling. You got Sting doing crazy dives. You've got your work rate match in there in Zach and Claudia. You've got all kinds of, you know, fun interactions between, you know, New Japan and AW guys. I suppose you can say, you know, although we painted as a negative in the build of the show, you've also left a lot on the table as far as big individual singles matches you can do. I would hope, you know, next time they do a match,
loads like on this, the table.
You get a proper Shingo singles match, and you get, you know, Brian and Punk healthy, and you can, you know, maybe
get Naito over. The card.
Oh yeah, get Naito over. Where was he? But yeah, as Darren said in the chat, it really did fly by. You know, I was up live for it. It was light outside by the time this thing finished, and you know, I was almost ready for more. I think that's the best thing you can say about a show this long, that you have, you know, that much fun from the buy-in onwards to that, you know. Again, while I don't agree with the people calling this one of the greatest wrestling shows of all time, I would call it one of the greatest undercards, or one of the most consistent undercards I've seen, with the, you know, maybe slight exception of Tony Storm and Thunder Rosa. You know, everything on this undercard absolutely delivered. I just thought it was just a great time watching it. I don't know if that was the feeling you got re-watching it today. Did you need to take any breaks?
Well, I did. I did need to at various points, but there's just more logistical reasons of dinner and stuff like that, and trying to do sort of like a few things at the same time. But this is a show that I'm wanting. Pardon me. This is a show I'm wanting to go back and see. I didn't get that feeling with Double or Nothing in there. I felt exhausted by the end of it, and I still think all of the criticisms of the build for this show are all very much still in place. But I think the thing that this had, and again, you know, to come back to it, is had an amazing crowd that lifted this up. And between the crowd and the wrestlers feeding off the crowd and wanting to kind of do more stuff and the crowd getting them more engaged, it's kind of like a virtuous circle, isn't it?
Mm.
Where everything is being kind of risen up to a good level. I think it's there is more potential for where this goes from here. It's just wrestling politics and my lack of faith around that as well, because you'll get egos in the room and the rest of it. However, what they should be looking at is, you know, even if, and I think we did predictions, didn't we, on the buy rate? You were on the slightly lower end. You were, I think we were around 90K. 80, and I think
80
I
was 100. My guess.
80 was yours. I said 100.
You might be dead on the money there.
It might be around, well, if you know, it shows a lot where AEW are. That we're talking, you know, 100,000. TNA's existed for 20 years. It's never done anything close to that. 60 odd is the highest for that. And that was
what's the split in the US? $25, is it? Like, is it half the?
I think so.
Is that what the average? Once you add in fight, then because that'll drag the average down. So what are we saying? Conservative estimate, 202 million off this.
Do they end up making? Mm-hmm. I always wait for the Brandon Howard Thurston when he does his kind of like guesstimations for this, and he always tends to be pretty good. And it always seems like they walk away with at least sort of like $4-4.5 million from it. There'll obviously be a split with New Japan, and I think this is where we get the finance side of it. And the fact that, A, the New Japan wrestlers were much more up for it than I expected it to be. Like, I honestly, I know that sounds like, but I didn't expect them all to be kind of like really engaged with it and engaged with the crowd like this. But you could tell how happy they were. And it's something I didn't take into consideration, how happy they would be to be in front of like noisy crowds, like a big, noisy, sold out crowd in an arena that's there.
Do you want to be there?
Made you want to be there for it. And and you've got to imagine New Japan probably won't get a split of the pay-per-views, but they'll get a split of the gate. That would be something. This is a conversation I had with WH about this before. They'll get a split of that gate and a split of that, you know, that's over $1 million gate at the United Center for it. And this show didn't turn out to be like the co-promoted show with Ring of Honor. Like, it was a world away from that. You didn't have, like, both promotions actually kind of lived up to it when it came to what is the stuff that happens in the ring.
Did they? I don't know. It felt like it reminded me of that, to be honest. Is that true?
No. What in terms of, like, no, but in the ring for this show, it was a lot of fun is the kind of overall point I suppose I'm trying to say. But they need to look at this in the cold light of day and go, hang on a minute, we've managed to sell out, like get 16,500 to turn up to this. We might be getting 100,000 pay-per-view buys. Now imagine if we gave this a degree of fucking thought and we had a full buy-in at both ends on this and go, right, let's do this, but we should be looking at a stadium. We should be looking at like kind of really making this like a proper supercard. And if they were going to do this again, rather than like, oh, you know, all the, and yes, there was a lot of like kind of bad luck to do with it, and they did better than I thought they did, and that's a good thing. And if I'm wrong on that front, if I was wrong before about like, because I was, people will know I was very down on this card. Really, like, honestly, I wasn't feeling engaged to it. It's part of a general malaise I've had with AEW, sort of slightly in the build to Double or Nothing, and then last few weeks of TV. And watching something like this, it reminded me about kind of why I loved wrestling. And like you said about being a celebration of wrestling, it was like, it was the kind of stuff where both AEW didn't really have a history per se, but New Japan's history and who they were was treated with the kind of level of respect that you kind of hoped it was as well. And like, they should both be coming away going, there's a lot of money to be made here, and there's a lot of talent that can be used in really good ways. So start fucking doing it.
Definitely, there's you know, something you can build on here. You know, the first is always going to be the first, you know, but you know, considering how much is left on the table, I think you could easily build, if it does turn out to be 100,000 buy show, you can build on that, can't you, and possibly do better next time. If you can finally do Zach and Brian, you can do, you know, Punk Tanahashi. They've been gifted that, really, haven't they? You could maybe do it at a better time of year as well, you know, when we haven't got G1 on the horizon and we haven't just got an AEW pay-per-view out the way, and we haven't, you know, as is specifically the case here, got fucking Blood and Guts coming up in 2 days, because That was one of the quick negatives I've got to say. As much as I was feeling the ProRes love and, you know, it was one of those fun nights on Twitter where everyone was having a great time. You know, everyone was enjoying the show. Yeah. You know, like I got a couple of people were maybe sending me some sarky tweets about in loving this, are you, Ben? I was like, well, yeah, I am actually. I'm having a really good time. I'm enjoying the show. I'm glad, you know, that it's a good show. That's absolutely a good thing.
I know you're going to get into the criticism of it for a second. Like, just to say on this, like, by being critical of something doesn't mean you want it to fail. It's just you want it to be as good as it possibly can be.
Mm.
And because then, as a wrestling fan, everyone's happy. Because if all wrestling, like, was really fucking good, then we'd probably be seeing some sort of, like, boom within it. At this point in time. So when stuff works, like, it has to be said, like, no, fair play, that worked. And on the night it did.
Look, if everything's good, nothing's good. Like, that's the...
Exactly.
You know, that's kind of like how I see life when it comes to film, music, wrestling, whatever. And, you know, we don't give this level of criticism to WWE, not because we think it's better. It's because we think it's considerably worse and not even worth spending the time critiquing, you know? It's because we love, you know, generally, you know, we've been very down on the AEW product the last month or so. You know, we generally, you know, enjoy AEW that we will, you know, pick out the negative. And I think there has been a relative swing to the negative. So, you know, I think I just hope things improve from a story point of view. Will says, yeah, speak for yourself, John Paul. He hates everything and he hopes it fails. Yeah, there is not. Being right is probably better than being entertained, in my opinion. But, you know, I'll take both, you know, in good moments. But I think the thing that did bring me crashing down, I was going to say then, as much as I was feeling the love, this angle at the end of the show. I mean, I've seen people who didn't mind it, and I've seen people who absolutely hated it, but it just reminded me, oh yeah, this is still the company we were watching, because Tony Khan had to just fucking shoehorn in another haphazard, we're out of time, end of Nitro brawl. That didn't even make any sense in the first place. Why were the babyfaces outnumbering the heels? Why was Jack Swagger leading the charge to make like a big save? Like, and then I know it was all to build up like Cesaro, Claudio coming out. We'll get that right one day. But I mean, like wrestling 101, Claudio already got his big pop earlier in the night. It was obviously going to be diminishing returns, which it was when he came out here. And then...
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy the Eddie Kingston stuff, you know, but Eddie Kingston's got his enemies, and I think he's, you know, great at making you believe he really hates these people, whether he does or he doesn't, which is definitely a question. But I don't think he did a very good job of shooting that. I feel like Kingston should have maybe got on the ring, and him and Claudio should have had some kind of focused upon moments. I know they tried to do it subtly, but then I think then the camera didn't really properly catch, you know, the bits you'd want it to catch. They were spending, you know, too much time with the camera focused elsewhere. You could just maybe out the corner of your eye see that, you know, Kingston was having a go at Claudio and wasn't happy. And to that point, you know, apart from like a throwaway jokey line from Excalibur going, oh, you know, everyone, you know, they've got a story history. It's like, have they? Like, I mean, I know they have, but like, I don't know, I feel like if you could give it like that extra bit of thought and focus, you could have told that story in 30 seconds of what Kingston's issue was. It felt like a timely reminder of, you know, what you're probably still in for with these Dynamites, because based on the post-show scrum, Tony Khan thinks that the last few weeks of Dynamite have been really good TV, so I think it's going to be more of this going forward. And yeah, it's shows upon shows, because yeah, no time to let this breathe and let us have a nice moment with Tanahashi and Moxley in the ring, because we've got blood and guts to sell on motherfucking Wednesday.
And you summed it up perfectly, that the Nitro-esque finish to this, where it was like, you've had this show. It's a show in isolation, obviously, you know, it's meant to be like, you know, it's a unique event. Just have it ending with the bloke who's won the title, celebrating winning the title, doing a shaking hands with Tanahashi before you start going into this and then distracting people again. And then kind of reminding me going, oh yeah, we've got this. Because all I thought about the Eddie Kingston, and it's all at work, but the thing I thought with the Eddie Kingston, Claudio stuff was that it was like, imagine if, like, you don't make reference to it, and Claudio comes out as part of Blackpool Combat Club, and Eddie Kingston's a bit wary teaming with him, and he's not really saying anything. But they win, and they get that victory, And then the week afterwards, like, they have some sort of speech, and Eddie Kingston goes, like, and then he starts to tell you the story, going, do you know what? Like, I know you're in this, like, you could start it properly from then. Give it a couple of weeks. What's the fucking rush? Like, why the rush to do this? If this was about getting people on the card, then like, it's like, you can't, like, you didn't need to do it. Like, the whole thing kind of felt like, it did feel like completely unnecessary. Like, didn't need it. Like, and it wasn't, yeah, I just, it felt like that's the kind of stuff you do on Dynamite. You do on your TV. You do it for this. It's, you know, you could always say, well, there'll be the fallout from the pay-per-view on Dynamite in there as well. But, like, this stuff, what a time at the end of a four-hour show to go, by the way, we've had him debut and he doesn't like Eddie Kingston. And there's a story behind it. You're like, what? Like,
I'm like, sure they'll flesh it out on Dynamite. But
I'm sure they will. But, like, Christ, there's time, isn't it? It's the ADHD stuff with Tony Khan and the booking at times. That is, it gets more infuriating the more we watch Dynamite as the years go on. You just go, for fuck's sakes, man, calm down for a couple of weeks. It's not in July yet. You know, All Out is until September 4th. You know, you're already rushing to a fucking blood and guts match next week.
Can't help himself, can he? Can't, but I guess we'll see. And yeah, we'll hopefully get a live take on Blood and Guts from, like I say, Steph's actually in Detroit now. She's just landed, apparently. So hopefully she'll join us for that show next week, and we can get her thoughts on that. But yeah, I think that kind of wraps us up for AEW and for Forbidden Door and New Japan. I don't know. Anything else you want to mention before we go, JP? Do you think, is the neck closing in on Vince McMahon? That's something that's broken this evening, the Rita Chatterton story, getting picked up by mainstream press. She gave an interview today, didn't she, Rita Chatterton? I think they got...
Didn't like see
a,
this.
Yeah, there's like a... there's a, what you call it, like an ex-wrestler, I'm trying to think of his name, who's allegedly corroborated this stuff with Rita Chatterton. It was New York Magazine that she gave a first interview years to. Mario Mancini, apparently, job wrestler from the 80s, has come out and backed up a story, and she's told a story again. Yeah, got picked up today by, like I say, New York Magazine printed it, but it's getting picked up by some major outlets, and I know where John Pollock did a great write up on it over on Post Wrestling as well. On a serious note, yeah, you would like to see that that story that kind of almost get not giggled about, but kind of just gets talked about, you know, the side of everyone's mouth. Maybe you know, get something behind it and get properly investigated.
It's the thing that we said about with this is there the point where they start to open up Pandora's box? Is this the first of the stories? It's New York Magazine. You know, this isn't like tabloid rag stuff. This isn't like the New York Post. This is the kind of stuff they do, big long form features generally. So, you know, imagine if it is getting picked up within those circles, that there's other stuff. It's whether or not it comes out. I mean, I must confess, I didn't know anything about this story until you said about it on this, but it's, you know, is there going to be another reaction from Vince McMahon which involves appearing on TV? Like, again, as a response to this, are you going to do this every time? Then there's something there.
Oh, we'll turn up on the Cena Raw tonight. Nailed on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's part of the. And does Cena want to be on Raw with him?
Maybe it'd be like that Rock one where he doesn't turn up. Remember that when they had like that love letter to the Rock for like, was it SummerSlam last year? Fuck, I didn't even bother coming. Maybe it'll be like that. But no, like I really hope that that gets some legs, that story. And yeah, we don't see it die down again. But yeah, outside of that, I think that's pretty much it really as far as the American wrestling. We'll obviously be back with another weekend show on Friday for our patrons, and as we said earlier, we'll be doing the half year in review with Grapple Gareth. Maybe we'll get some Forbidden Door thoughts from him in the mix there as well. But plenty are coming up on the Patreon side. JP, anything else you want to plug?
No, I say we had the season finale, me and WH of Hello There. So have a listen to that. There's the season finale of Kenobi on there as well. And yeah, patreon.com/grapple. Like I say, we've had the TNA month one recently as well, but like weekend show some of the daily updates. You know, we're always got stuff out there.
Audio version of Spotlight that has the pre and post show on it that goes out to all patrons.
Yes.
So, you know, there you go. Get plenty of a bang for your buck over there. So yeah, patreon.com/grapple if you want to support us. But yeah, other than that, that's it for us for another week, I would say. Cheers from me. Cheers from JP. We will catch you again next week.
Bye.
Cheers, all.
For hours, every day, so many drinks, such pretty flowers. So tell me, what have I done to deserve this? What have I done to deserve this? What have I, since you went?